over the centuries. That's How Did We Get Here? Israel and the Palestinians with me, Johnny Diamond, on Monday evenings at 8 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Laurie Taylor presents Thinking Aloud in 5 minutes after the latest news here on Radio 4.
BBC News at 6 o'clock on Sunday, the 8th of February. This is Lisa Costello. Good morning. Foreign Office sources say officials are reviewing a payoff given to Lord Mandelson after he was sacked as ambassador to the US, which could be worth about £40,000. The peer was dismissed in September over his relationship with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Emails released by the US Justice Department last month suggest he passed information to Epstein when he was serving in Gordon Brown's cabinet. Police are investigating allegations of misconduct in a public office. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment, but BBC News understands his position is that he has not acted in any way criminally and that he was not motivated by financial gain. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The review was announced following fresh details about Lord Mandelson's contact with Jeffrey Epstein in the latest tranche of the Epstein files and after the launching of a separate police investigation. The government has said that Lord Mandelson's payoff was in line with legal advice it had received and normal civil service practice. But Lord Mandelson's appointment was hardly run-of-the-mill, so a review of the settlement will be designed to reduce the potential political toxicity of paying him to leave his post. Number 10 sources have suggested that Lord Mandelson shouldn't await the review and either pay the money back or give it to a charity which supports victims. Lord Mandelson's lawyers have been approached for comment.
Millions in Japan are voting in a snap election called just 2 weeks ago. Japan's first female Prime Minister, Sanae Takeuchi, is hoping that her personal popularity can overturn ill feeling towards her governing party. Shaima Khalil reports from outside a polling station in Tokyo.
Voters have braved heavy snowfall across Japan to head to the polls, with concern that the freezing conditions could affect turnout. Sanae Takeuchi is betting on her personal popularity, hoping to deliver a clear mandate for the long-governing but deeply unpopular Liberal Democratic Party. The LDP has been tainted by financial scandals, which cost her predecessor his job and led to the party losing control of both chambers of Japan's parliament last year. But with just over 3 months in office, she's managed to distance herself from the party's image by focusing on diplomacy and cultivating a big social media following.
The government is bringing in changes to apprenticeships, which it says are crucial for economic growth. The duration of courses will be cut to as little as 3 months, and thousands of young people will be fast-tracked into what ministers say will be high-quality jobs. The Work and Pensions Secretary, Pat McFadden, says the plans will slash bureaucracy and help young people into employment.
It's all about speed and agility in the apprenticeship programme. We all know it takes too long in this country to get things built, and the announcement that we're making today is a contribution to speeding up that process.
The parents of two teenage sisters who were unlawfully killed in the Hillsborough disaster are launching a campaign to change official court records surrounding the circumstances of their children's deaths. Trevor and Jenny Hicks's daughters, Sarah and Vicky, were among 97 Liverpool fans who died as a result of the crush in Sheffield in 1989. Initially, police said the girls died without prolonged suffering. Later, proceedings established that wasn't true, but there's currently no mechanism to record the change on court documents. The authorities in northern Italy say they believe that three incidents of suspected sabotage affecting railway lines might have been linked to the first official day of competition at the Winter Olympics. The damage caused disruption for thousands of travellers. Joe Inwood reports.
A small cabin set alight near Pesaro, electric cables severed in Bologna, and a rudimentary explosive found nearby. All three incidents were discovered by the Italian authorities within a few hours of each other. There were some delays to the state-run rail network. Italy's transport minister called them serious sabotage, most likely designed to disrupt the first full day of the Winter Olympics. Matteo Salvini compared them to similar attempts to sabotage the French rail network as Paris hosted the Summer Games. On Thursday, Italian authorities say they foiled a number of cyber attacks, which they blamed on Russia.
At the Winter Olympics in Italy, the veteran American skier Lindsey Vonn will be hoping to overcome a knee injury to win back the downhill title she last won in 2010. And the teenage British snowboarder Maya Brooks begins her campaign for a medal. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss is following the games from Cortina.
The women's downhill skiing could provide the story of these Olympics. 16 years after she won the title, America's Lindsey Vonn is aiming to do it again. Now 41 years old, she had been in impressive form, but last week her hopes seemed over when she suffered a serious knee injury in a crash. Remarkably though, she's still going to compete and clocked the third fastest time in training yesterday. One of Britain's medal contenders, meanwhile, will make her debut here. 19-year-old Maya Brooks is hoping to become Britain's youngest Winter Olympic medalist for 78 years as she goes in qualifying in the women's big air snowboarding event.
BBC News.
Lisa Costello, many thanks. This is BBC Radio 4. Coming up, how does the environment we move through shape the way we see and experience the world? We're thinking aloud about that question in just a moment. Then we meet the Wagyu farmer in North Norfolk, whose animals have taught her to be more zen. That's in On Your Farm. It's in half an hour.
When you're cozied up on the sofa, when the drama's got you totally hooked, when you're completely engrossed in what's about to happen.
Hey, did you eat all these?
Oh, sorry, didn't notice.
Go on, there's more in the kitchen.
Nothing brings us together like great TV. And a TV license covers you to watch all TV channels, so you can make the most of those long, dark nights. It also funds everything you love from the BBC, including iPlayer and Radio 4. Find out more at tvl.co.uk.
Now here's Laurie Taylor with Thinking Aloud.
Hello. Frankly, I'm a bit of a Liverpool bore. I mean, if any of my London friends so much as mention the Cavern or Pierhead or Anfield, I'm liable to launch into lengthy accounts of my magical teenage years in the city. So I was dead chuffed when a recent coincidence found me in the city with a fellow sociologist who had never before sampled its delights. "Show me around," he pleaded. "Show me around." Well, it was an enticing invitation. But too many years had passed. Well, it used to be there, became my common refrain, as I could no longer see Lewis's department store, the news theatre in Clayton Square, the ferry to New Brighton, the overhead railway, the futurist cinema. Even some of the streets had become alien. At one new intersection, I made the shocking admission, "Look, I'm sorry, mate, but I'm a bit lost." Well, I was reminded of that uneasy urban sensation, that memory loss, when I read some moving research by my next guest on the problems encountered by people with dementia who use public transport to travel around Manchester. Well, that guest is James Fletcher, Assistant Professor in Digital Futures at the University of Bath, and author of a research article entitled "Navigating Dementia, Political Materialities of Public Transport in the All-Aging Metropolis." He now joins me. Firstly, James, tell me a little bit about the methodology you're using. I mean, it's really rather unusual, isn't it?
Yes, so I use something that we'd broadly refer to as creative go-along methods. There are a couple of components to that. So the creative side of things involves giving my participants a range of different means that they can then choose from in order to document their lives. And that includes filming, taking photographs, recording soundscapes, potentially sketching. I even had one participant who knitted. And so this really diversifies the ways that we can gather information from people. And then the go-along component of that means that I use all of those methods as we travel around the city. So rather than sitting in their homes and conducting a traditional interview, we sort of chat or don't chat along the way.
And you're recording all the time, are you?
Often, if they want to or if they don't, we can use other means. I can take notes. The point is that it's entirely up to them.
OK, well, let's turn now to the specifics of your research. Who were involved in it? Who were the subjects? And what were you trying to establish?
So I have for a long time been quite interested in the mobilities of people with dementia, because when I first started doing dementia research, I sort of naively went along to interview people expecting the problems of dementia that they talked about to be toileting, forgetting loved ones, the kind of stereotypes you might have. And people very consistently told me that the worst part had been losing their driving license and the sort of immobility that that led to. On the other hand, the UK benefits from this older person's bus pass, which means that we actually have a remarkably, in theory, accessible system for older people with dementia. But we know that while 80% of people take up their bus passes, fewer than 40% actually use those bus passes. So this is a really intractable issue, because obviously it leads to quite profound isolation for people, which can then worsen their cognitive impairment. And so I'm really interested in how people with dementia do or very often don't get around.
Yes, the word cognition and cognitive, that's a word that interests you, isn't it?
Very much so. Particularly through the 20th century, we've thought of cognition as information processing that is happening inside your skull in a very small space. But we've increasingly come to appreciate that that is not really the case. The way that you and I process information is happening out in the world. And examples of that might include, you know, counting on your fingers, making a shopping list, using a smartphone to navigate a city. But the problem is we often study cognition in a lab setting or even in a small magnetic tube. And that is very, very far away from how cognition really works if we want to understand it.
And the distinctive thing about this is you're travelling on public transport with people with dementia. I mean, they're not really subjects who are being experimented on. I mean, you're sitting by their side and listening to what they say.
Yeah, and this is a really important part of the history of dementia research, because sadly, for much of that history, people with dementia were largely treated as test subjects to be experimented on. And if we wanted any insight into their experiences or preferences, we would often ask a loved one as a sort of proxy for their experiences. And over the past 30 years, the discipline has gradually moved towards more inclusive methods and more valuing of those people's experiences as legitimate experiences. The problem is, in some ways, that began with simply conducting interviews with people. And if you have a cognitive impairment and I sit down with you and I ask you to recall things, to articulate them to me, to comprehend questions, that can be almost sort of uniquely cruel to a person who may have impairments in these domains. So by travelling around and joining in people's normal lives with them, that allows them to participate in different ways.
So why in the first place did you select people with dementia to travel with? You wanted to find out how they could still manage Manchester on the bus despite their cognitive condition, did you?
Yeah, and I think it's really important to state that the people I worked with are in quite a unique position, because the vast majority of people with dementia are not freely using a complex public transport network every day. These are people who, for whatever reason, are particularly successful, despite experiencing many challenges of their own, at navigating a large city on a multimodal transport network. And I was really interested in their success stories, for want of a better term, so how they were actually managing to do this, because we know that so many aren't and that that has quite profound consequences for their lives.
I was very interested in the way in which, as you're travelling along on these buses with your participants, the city itself becomes really a character in the story, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I think the thing about go-along methods is that they do turn everybody into a sociologist, because we say we live in a place. I might say I lived in Manchester, but the reality is I live in a house and an office and the pub and very rarely go elsewhere. But when you're on public transport, you really experience Manchester as a place, and as you say, as a character. It is a city, like many cities, that is riven with deep socioeconomic inequalities, with quite profound racial segregation. And these are the things that between your office and your house, you might not notice. But as you travel and move around the city, you really pick up on these things. And particularly for people who are experiencing aging. They've often, you know, some of my participants had lived there for, I think my oldest participant was in their 90s. So they'd lived there a very, very long time and experienced profound change through post-industrial decline, the rebuilding of the city as this tech hub with glittering skyscrapers. And it was interesting that in many ways we were side by side and in the same moment, but experiencing two very different cities. And I lived in Manchester for 4 years. I was new to the city, but in many ways, I was more of a local than them in the city centre, because that city centre has been rebuilt for people like me. I'm a young guy moving to work in the higher education sector. That city is built in my image, despite them having lived there for so long. In many ways, I was the local.
You travelled with one of your interviewees, Paul, to his local bus stop at the top of his street in Bolton. Now, I'm going to play a little clip here in which Paul describes how woefully lacking this bus stop is for the people who live there.
It's absolutely horrendous most of the time. And it's totally unsuitable for most people, but for like people with disability, what's got it is overhanging bushes, which means that the bus stop sign is covered, and they can't put a shelter there. I waited for a bus here one day for 2.5 hours, and gave up in the end.
2.5 hours. And you describe how some of the older residents, many of them who lived in Manchester for decades, they felt as though the city had, there's a little quote here, aged past them. How did all these changes affect how they moved through the city?
One of the really profound things about the way that we navigate cities generally with public transport is that we often have this spoken hub model, which means that you have to travel into the centre, make a connection to an alternative bus or tram, and then move out again. So people were often having to take quite circuitous routes that led them through the city centre. The problem is, if you have wayfinding difficulties and you rely on the familiarity of landmarks in order to be able to navigate the city, then this frenetic change in the centre of Manchester can be massively disorientating, because the reality of Manchester in recent years with the building boom was that you could not really rely on the same road layout being in place a fortnight later. The city was truly fluid. It was moving all the time, and that really disorientated a lot of people.
It's fascinating that the transport inefficiencies, I mean, the very things the planners are trying so hard to eliminate, make everything smooth running, they actually create really moments of sociability. They're opportunities for people to talk to each other.
Yeah, this was a really interesting experience to me, because when I first moved to Manchester to do this project, particularly some of my participants who perhaps otherwise didn't really leave their house for the rest of the week, that it was those moments of the bus not turning up or being 20 minutes late that would cause, you know, they'd give rise to a brief conversation between two sort of jokingly frustrated passengers. And that was a really, really meaningful social interaction. And to some extent, the sort of nominal reasons that people would give me for going on these journeys seemed slightly suspect. And I wondered whether actually the beauty of going out and catching buses around Manchester was largely because you could talk to the person with the dog or the baby and talk to people when the bus was late and when things broke down and signs didn't work.
I'm fascinated by another point here, because the ways in which public transport systems are moving increasingly towards cashless payments, digital displays, ticket offices closing, how is this impacting upon people who, I mean, sort of people you're dealing with cognitive impairments?
Yeah, so dementia is this massively idiosyncratic symptoms. So different people experience different types of impairments. And I don't want to feed into the, frankly, quite false stereotype that people with dementia per se can't use digital technologies, because that's not the case. But these sorts of new digital systems can cause particular difficulties for particular people. So there's the example in my paper of Joyce, who used to actually quite deftly navigate the local bus routes and make transfers quite well. The one time that you could really appreciate that she had pronounced cognitive impairment was when we got to the bus station where the ticket desk was de-staffed and the information board was now one of these classic electronic boards with, you know, the bus numbers and times and locations flowing across the screen. And it is at these particular moments that Joyce would effectively shut down, and we would stand there for 5-10 minutes and she would become confused and mumble and be an entirely different Joyce to the Joyce who I travelled with for the rest of the day. And this is just one instance where those sorts of small digital changes can make a big difference to how people travel.
James Fletcher, just thank you very much for the moment. And I must thank also Vali Alexander, Alice Johnson, Deirdre Lay and Simon Heathfield for their very interesting and perceptive comments on last week's programme on colour. Actually, I still find it interesting that nearly half of the people I quiz still go on insisting that some Like It Hot, the film, was in colour. It wasn't. Comments on today's programme, hugely welcome. You'll find me at thinkingaloud@bbc.co.uk. Well, I'm now very pleased because I can turn to a researcher who makes the dramatic assertion that there is, and I quote, a politics to getting lost. He is Alex Pryor, who's a lecturer in politics at London South Bank University, and he's the author of an article entitled Go Along Research in the UK Parliament. He's now with me. Alex, I've got to ask you about that phrase, having been lost myself. What do you mean by the politics of getting lost, and how does that relate to this research into Parliament?
Yeah, so I think it has something to do with the fact that Parliament, depending on what part of it you're in and what building you're in, is a very, very easy place to lose oneself physically. I think there are all kinds of discussions, therefore, to be had about the kind of power relationships and dynamics within that place, where maybe it's a place in which all but a select few are supposed to be lost, or at least feel themselves to be slightly discombobulated. But I was really interested in that question of negotiation and navigation within an institution like Parliament. So much of it, I think, is a kind of index of power, being able to find oneself or being able to avoid getting lost, but also things like the amount of time it takes you to move through a place like that. Yeah. So in some sense, that can be a reading of power, that someone who knows the place well and has doors open for them can move through it quickly. But there's also maybe a politics to being able to be late for things.
I mean, you chose Parliament. You chose to look at Parliament because you thought that the people who were there would be able to tell you a great deal about how an environment was explored.
Yes, and that different groups and communities within Parliament would have different perspectives on things like inclusion and belonging. But it seemed like a fascinating place, and quite a sort of complementary place, to do go-along research, and raised challenges which were in themselves interesting.
Perhaps you could describe that to me and tell me its benefits, its advantages.
Sure, absolutely. So simply put, it just consists of accompanying a interviewee around a particular space to talk about what it means to them as a place. So something really great about the go-along method is that a person can essentially sort of narrate a place to you by picking out certain details and you using certain visual cues. I think it avoids talking about the place as an abstraction, kind of at a distance. You're actually, as James was saying as well, you're kind of having an experience of the place at the same time that might actually be quite distinct.
So there's a limited number of people that you do this with. I mean, how many, for example, in this study would you have spoken to?
Around 15, something like that. They're quite hard to organise, and I think there's probably something about the parliamentary setting that is relevant to that as well. Not everyone can participate in them, which maybe we can come back to later as a challenge, an inherent challenge of the go-along. And we found that it was more difficult to get certain sort of MPs and certain parties to...
So you're walking along with them in Parliament. I mean, how do you choose where to go? Do they choose where to go?
They choose where to go, and that was a very deliberate decision. I think we really wanted this to be a storytelling experience where the person we were interviewing decided how it went.
Tell me something. What sort of places are we talking about with inside Parliament?
So it can be anything from very recognisable and kind of obviously symbolically important areas like Westminster Hall, for example, to even slightly smaller and perhaps less, kind of tourism-worthy items like particular doors or particular cafes. It really depended on the person. Sometimes they were keen to show us quote-unquote kind of secret places within Parliament, maybe not so secret, but very personal to them as a place.
You're asking them, what sort of questions are you asking them? You're asking them, what are they making of this place? What does it mean to you?
Exactly. So things like, do you remember how you felt when you first came into Parliament? When was that? Was it as part of a tour group? What, you know, how did that feel? What kind of places in Parliament are your favourites? Asking them questions about the sort of planned and ongoing restoration and renewal project for Parliament, whether things like COVID-19 had a very major effect on how they experience the place and how they navigate it. But it's all with a nudge to talk about what the place means subjectively to them. You were kind of talking earlier about sort of your Liverpool, and I think we wanted to get that kind of insight for Parliament from those who we call everyday users.
I mean, you didn't just speak to MPs, you spoke to clerks, to officials, big mix of parliamentary employees altogether.
Yes.
Why did you want that broad section of people?
Just because we thought that it would be really useful to get as wide a spectrum of everyday users as possible. Talking to members of the public about it probably deserves its own paper and deserves its own research project. But I think we were conscious that if we spoke only to MPs, for example, we would be getting one particular perspective, certainly not a homogenous perspective.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, that some of those people who felt they were sort of insiders or outsiders or whatever. I mean, it was rather strange that some people who were insiders didn't feel themselves to be so.
Yeah, and we thought that was so fascinating. Again, sort of coming back to those ideas of belonging and inclusivity. Most every person that we spoke to had a reason for not feeling entirely that they belonged. There was always a reason in some sense to be an outsider, and the way that they related to Parliament. Again, you were talking earlier about sort of Manchester as a character in the story. The way that Parliament was included as a character in the story was really fascinating. But people who would normally assume to be or feel like insiders didn't necessarily feel that way. That's exactly
relating to that point. We voiced up one of the comments of your interviewees. This is a parliamentary clerk.
I get asked for my pass all the time, and it's not as bad for me as it is for particularly my women friends who are not white, especially when they're young. And they're clerks, so they have the most access. They have to be in lobbies and in the chamber, and they get stopped all the time. And there was a long period where doorkeepers and security guards were like, oh, it's just because it's a pandemic, we don't recognise anyone, which was probably true for a few months, but it's definitely not an excuse anymore.
questions like the sort of questions you might expect from security staff, things like sort of, do you belong here? Are you meant to be here? You can sort of run with that. You can kind of stretch that question and really get a sense of how politically meaningful and significant and kind of resonant that is. Even during one of the go-alongs, we got stopped by security, and the response of that particular interviewer was to say, it's kind of important that this was captured in a sense because this doesn't happen to other staff members who represent perhaps a slightly different demographics. So there's something structurally very problematic that participants, even as you say, people you would assume to be insiders, were picking up.
I was very much taken in a way by the one of your participants who talked about the front stage, backstage nature of Parliament, the sense that wherever you are in the place, you're always performing a role. Could you just expand on that?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And actually, that's a topic of some further research with people like Sophia Pizarro, who's mentioned in the paper. I think that's such an interesting discussion because I think there's sometimes a perception that if you're in the debating chamber, for example, that's when the performance begins. And if you're in a corridor, that's where the performance ends and that's where the mask comes off. I think papers like this and research like this is a really good way of collapsing that dichotomy, collapsing that distinction, and basically making an argument that it is a site and space of performance of some kind or another. It might be a different performance, might be a different style of performance, but there's always a kind of, again, I think pretty consistent with theatre studies, even backstage or offstage, there's a form of performance that's going on. So I think it just adds a bit of nuance and a bit of richness to that distinction.
Turning to the future for a moment, newspapers at the beginning of this year asked if 2026 would finally be the year that MPs and peers would agree on how to repair Parliament. Indeed, talk of the project Restoration and Renewal cropped up repeatedly in your research. I mean, what is this? And how are your interviewees responding to different ideas about how we approach all these changes that are being envisaged?
With a considerable amount of anxiety, I think would be the word. Some of the participants I was speaking to, one in particular actually mentioned that there were colleagues of theirs who were, I think the terms they used were kind of structurally alienated or sort of culturally alienated structurally from this place, who nevertheless would be very anxious about changing it. And I think it comes back in some sense to this characterization, this humanization, this kind of made tangible Parliament, almost like the sort of relative or friend who occasionally says embarrassing things at parties, yeah, who yeah. nevertheless wouldn't necessarily want to change fundamentally. And I think it goes back to this idea that it's very difficult to know what thread to pull. It's very difficult to know what kind of deep structural change that could be made that would wholesale improve the place without compromising or jeopardizing some of the things that give it a, I'm not sure if charm is the right word, but just its character or its
You have a lovely illustration of this, or metaphor, or whatever one might want to call it, because someone you talk about told you about seeing this loose wire hanging from the ceiling in Parliament, and I love this, with a small note attached to it saying something like, don't touch this wire, we know it's hanging, but we don't know what it's connected to. You describe that as the perfect anecdote. Why perfect?
Sometimes they write themselves, rather, I think. I think, again, it just comes back to that point about kind of thread pulling, not knowing exactly what change is going to be made that actually has very negative, unintended consequences. And I think even people who are quite critical of the sort of physical fabric of the institution and had lots of critiques to make of it, and there are certainly lots of critiques to be made, nevertheless weren't that they didn't sort of come forward that quickly or that clearly with solutions or kind of ways of fixing it. And I think it explains some of the anxiety around restoration and renewal it's difficult to say this categorically, but I think one of the ideas and notions that we had was that losing something like your office, your kind of sanctuary, where perhaps you don't feel like you have to perform, unlike the corridors, unlike the debating chambers, unlike those other places that nevertheless you are having to perform, the prospect of losing that, maybe not to return to it within the scope of your term in office, etc., might be a root of some of the anxiety around R&R, or at least one of the elements there.
Alex Pryor, James Fletcher, I really enjoyed speaking to both of you. Forgive my indulgence, but I can't forsake all this talk about urban spaces and places without quoting a local hero's personification of his hometown. Liverpool, George Harrison once observed, is full of the kind of people who go out on a Monday and couldn't care less about Tuesday morning.
Thinking Aloud is presented by Laurie Taylor. It's produced by Natalia Fernandez. We meet a one-woman Wagyu beef farmer in just a moment. And looking ahead later this morning, Sunday worship at 8:10 is a service from Exeter Cathedral as part of the Northern European Cathedrals Conference. This week, Radio 4 explores the weight loss drug revolution.
I'm no longer ravenous. I'm no longer desperate. I'll no longer eat until I fall asleep and I have to rest.
The Hunger Game, a new 5-part series exploring the meteoric rise of weight loss drugs.
It's been an incredible story with these drugs. The uptake, the amount of product that's been sold, the amount of money it's cost, the amount of money that's been made.
What the drugs do, how they work, and the knock-on effects of their widespread use.
People are having to completely alter the way they do business.
The Hunger Game with me, Professor Giles Yeo. This Monday to Friday, lunchtime at 1:45. To listen on your smart speaker, just say, play Radio 4.
Now for On Your Farm, where Anna Hill meets a woman rearing a herd of Wagyu cattle, a breed originating from Japan, famous for producing high-quality marbled beef.
That's a new gate,
it
Sarah.
Is a new gate. Yes, it's still a bit stiff in places.
Welcome to On Your Farm. I'm with Sarah Juggins in sort of West Norfolk, middle of Norfolk.
West Norfolk, sort of veering towards the North Norfolk, I suppose. But we claim to be West Norfolk and proud of it here.
We're looking across a landscape which is low-lying with quite old trees here and an old boundary. And I dare I say an old Land Rover
yeah.
in the distance.
The Land Rover isn't quite as old as I am, but yeah, it's got a good 35 years worth of service. And to be truthful, I bought it as a sort of vanity project, but as you can see, it's gone from being vanity to being
less than vanity.
It's definitely a work tractor, and I think people would pay good money for the mud splats all over it.
The reason we're here is we've come to talk to you about your Wagyu animals, beef animals. And as soon as I say the word Wagyu, you sort of, your face softened up, because they're not a vanity project, but they are an emotional project for you, aren't they? Can I say that you are a farmer, but your whole business isn't farming?
Yeah, I get regularly told off by various members of the farm cluster group that I run for not calling myself a farmer, but I don't claim to be a farmer. I rent land, I graze cattle across it. I'm a beef producer, I suppose, or a cattle farmer, or a grazier, any one of those titles, but I would hesitate to call myself a true farmer.
Let's walk down to the tractor, as you're calling it. Where did you start? How did you start with the beef and why?
So I have had a bit of a, I suppose you'd call it a journeyful career. I've been a teacher, I've been a journalist, I've lived in Cambridge and London, but my roots are here in Norfolk. In fact, my father had a mixed farm probably about 3 miles away from here, and his big passion on that farm was cattle. When I moved back here, I was lucky enough with house prices and things to be able to sell a very small two-up, two-down in Cambridge for a house here with some land. So the idea was just to get a couple of small cattle, just to see if I remembered the things that I used to do with my dad on the farm. You know, I helped him from the age of probably 5 until I left home at 18 with every aspect of rearing the cattle. And I wanted to see if I remembered how to do it and whether I could just keep two small cattle, so I bought two very short-legged little Dexter cattle, which I kept on 4 acres of land. And then I, some would say, made the mistake, but I think opened up Pandora's box and a world of opportunities, because I then bought a Wagyu.
What made you choose Wagyu?
Well, the Dexters were going well. I suppose I tapped into my second passion, which is eating. And I went to Zuma in London, which is a well-known Wagyu restaurant, tasted that and thought, wow, this is quite spectacular. I did a bit of research and I spoke to a chap called Steve Ramshaw, who till recently ran Northumbria Wagyu up in the northeast, and he had an in-calf Wagyu heifer that he was willing to sell me. So Winnie arrived.
Winnie the Wagyu. Let me talk to you a little bit about the influence of your father. Starting at 5 years old, looking after the cattle, you must have absolutely loved it, which is why you came back to do it.
He allowed me to get very involved from a very early age, so I'm pretty sure at the back of his mind he was probably questioning his own parenting principles, but I was the person who was helping him when he was calving. I was tugging on the ropes at a very early age. You know, Christmas morning, the joy was actually being allowed to feed all the cattle before I went back into the house for Christmas presents. Yeah, it was a really, really lovely thing to do. Yeah, I was very lucky. So when Winnie had her calf, at that point he wasn't able to walk very well, but we brought in some modern technology and he sat at the end of the field in his car watching the birth via FaceTime and was able to talk me through it. So, you know, that was a really quite a special moment.
How lovely that he involved you when you were little, and when he was elderly you involved him.
I absolutely hadn't thought of it like that, but yeah, it was, I suppose that's a circle, isn't it? And we talk about all these different circles of life, and that was ours. Yeah.
Let's get on with it. I know we've got a freezing cold wind today, haven't we?
Yeah.
But it's actually beautiful. On the back of what you're calling your tractor, you have this system, I think I can only call it, where you have a round bale. Sarah's in the cab. You want me to come in?
Come on.
Yeah.
We're going to drive it just a little bit further so that we're on a slope, so that when I roll the bale off, it's then very easy to roll and get the string off. So I might be involving you in that, Anna.
OK. I'm here to work.
So, here we go. And it's quite a nice dry surface, so the Land Rover, which has got extra large wheels for this purpose, will find a nice spot on a nice clean piece of grass, ignore the molehills, and come to a stop there. And we're going to hop out and unwind the back.
Hey! Here we go. So we've got a handle, yeah. A ratchet. We're unscrewing that wire.
Yep,
and we're tipping.
Like we tip it. Now what I just need to do is hop in the Land Rover and pull that away, and then we're hoping to unwind the bale.
So Sarah's just driving forward now. She's pulled away. The bale is placed nicely in the middle of the field, ready for the cattle. And this is very nice hay. Oh, sorry, that was my job. Sorry, was it? Sorry, I was supposed to do that. Just winding that wire back in again. And we're going to unwrap it.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to roll it.
There you go. You're getting work out today, Anna.
I am. It's quite mesmerising, isn't it? Whoa! This is more fun than it should be. Oh, we're going to watch it roll away. That's so fantastic.
I know some people like to roll them out fully, but I like the cattle to come and play and enjoy the hay and, you know, generally just be kids, really.
This year was quite difficult, though, isn't it? I mean, yeah. This winter fodder, the drought and not that much grass growing.
Yeah, it was a real problem. I mean, I was very lucky to secure quite a number of bales of this good quality hay, but not enough, actually. So what we've got over here, if you...
Yeah, let's have a look.
This is a silage that's been made out of wild bird mix. This is where collaboration is at its best, isn't it? Because this was another farmer, and he said to me, I've got quite a grassy mix here, would you like to take it for silage? And it was something we'd never done before. Now it's not the best, but they get that as well as the hay, and they seem really happy with it, which is pleasing because I've got 80 bales of it, so, you know, I'm pleased they're happy with it. Another farmer has been growing me pea silage, so we use vining peas and make silage from that, which is a really, really lovely mix for the cattle as well.
How many animals have you got at the moment?
I have got 36 at the moment.
Wow, that's a lot to look after.
It's a lot to look after.
And it's just you?
It's just me, yeah. If I have a day, like a TB testing, for example, friends and neighbours will come and help with that sort of thing. I've got a farmer down the road who helps me if I need to move things, you know, on a big scale. People help, you know, the community helps, and I think that's a really, really lovely thing. And I pay them back with boxes of beef every so often and things like that.
Coming from Japan, these animals, what are they used to? What's the culture out there? Have you been to see?
Well, it's very, very different. And this is the point of difference that I'm quite proud of. So Wagyu that comes from Japan, people will be very, very familiar with the pictures of almost completely white meat, you know, because it's so run through with marbled fat. I don't think that's particularly palatable for the majority of the British diet. And the reason it's like that is because these animals are kept in conditions that... I'm not judging this. These are conditions that works for the Japanese Wagyu market. They're kept in buildings. They are fed an extremely scientifically and rigorously tested diet that will allow the marbling to develop to its very, very best potential. Key to all of that is the genetics of the animals, so making sure you've got the right genetics to produce the high marbling. And then they're kept in those buildings. So they don't get an awful lot of exercise, and I'm a former PE teacher, and I think that everybody should do exercise. So this is my point of difference. My cattle, they have the right genetics, they have access to great quality food, but they also move a lot. And this means that they've got muscle and they've got fat. So when you see the meat from Norfolk Wagyu, and from actually an awful lot of the Wagyu producers in Britain, yes, there'll be marbling, and there'll be quite a high degree of marbling compared to other breeds of cattle, but it won't be that type white Japanese fat that we've got.
So we're just walking up to a building here, and we've got a couple of houses. Oh, we can see them just around the corner. They're very used to people, aren't they?
Yeah,
or
they
used
are.
To you?
Yes, yeah. I mean, this is, again, one of the things. You'll see I'm carrying a brush. I generally walk in and start to do this just because I want them to always be stress-free, always to allow me to handle them. Yes, it does them good as well, and yes, it keeps their coats quite nice, but it just gives us that little bit of extra contact with them, which means that when it comes to getting them moved or getting them in the crusher treatment or whatever it might be, that they remain stress-free. And I think that's probably my biggest mantra, is can I rear a stress-free herd? That means that you get very nice marbled meat at the end of it, because if they get...
Does it make a difference?
Yes, it does, yeah. If they get stressed, then I think it's adrenaline or insulin or something gets into the system, and so that marbling that you've worked so hard to, you know, get... tends to reduce a little bit. So yes, it's really important that they remain stress-free. She's a pedigree Wagyu.
She's got a high back end.
Yep.
She is narrow in her body and quite delicate legs.
Really delicate.
And they're a lovely velvety black all over. Oh, right, that's the male. And he's got a neck on him like a bull would have.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's got lovely horns. They're quite cone-like.
Yes. Someone described the Wagyu faces as looking like Assegai warriors, you know, because they've got that sort of that angular, and then with the horns coming out as well. She is one of my first cattle. I bought her. She's actually an Aberdeen Angus.
Yes, her legs are completely different.
Yeah. So she's an Aberdeen Angus who actually was carrying an embryo Wagyu calf. So I bought four embryos and had them implanted into Aberdeen, you know, big cows, so the birth would be easy. And she was such a good mum that I kept her, and she's been crossed with the Wagyu bull ever since. There are two ways of basically categorising what you would call pedigree Wagyu. So you could either be full blood, which is a animal that is directly descended from the... I think there were three Japanese bulls in the first instance.
Just three.
So if they're full blood Wagyu, then their line can be traced directly back to those bulls. Then you've got purebred, and purebred are the ones that have been gradually bred through, so starting with that cow, the Aberdeen, going to her daughter. She becomes an F1, her daughter becomes an F2, F3. When they reach F4 status, they are then officially, according to the Wagyu Association, pure Wagyu. They can never be called full blood, but they can be called purebred.
So terminology is important, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yeah. What have you come to say? Hello, sweetheart. Yes. This is Jono, who was born 18 months ago, and he absolutely loves a little head scratch. He's a purebred, so he's been bred through.
You mentioned about your other jobs. So yeah. Tell me a little bit about... Because you do work as well as doing this.
I do, yeah. So, yeah, the cows were a money pit. There's absolutely no doubt about that. So, you know, they're a breed that you need to keep for a minimum of 3 years if you're going to get the very best marbling. So when Winnie was flushed and had her embryos, I was thinking, well, this is not going to start paying back for at least 4 years, in effect. And that process itself was quite expensive. So, yes, there was investment in the first instance. There's obviously costs involved with land, with the food, etc., etc. And I would say that probably, if I'm being completely honest, I've only just really started to turn a profit with the cattle and the beef sales and things.
And how long have you been going?
I've been going since with Wagyu since 2016. So
it's 10 years this year.
So it's 10 years this year. Yes. So
and you're just turning a profit.
So I'm just turning a profit. Yes. You know, there's an awful lot of crossover between the various bits of work that I do. So I think I said to you, I run a farm cluster. So a farm cluster is a collaborative group of farmers who come together over a common purpose. So I run the North Norfolk Coastal Group with a colleague, Charlie Ennells, and I suppose we were based around a biodiversity audit. So an awful lot of the work that we did and continue to do is around helping, supporting farmers into doing things that are good for farming but also benefit the environment. So, you know, a lot of emphasis on cover cropping, on margins, on hedgerows, ponds, etc., etc. The group has developed. We now sort of look at other things like succession planning and business planning and how the next generation can start to have an influence before they take up the reins, all those sorts of social aspects as well. So that's that farm cluster. And then I also work with David Lyles, who's quite well known in the Norfolk area as a farmer and conservationist, to run something called the Cluster Landscape Connect, which is a, for want of a better word, a cluster of clusters or a super cluster. And we provide support to the 23 cluster groups that are currently in existence in Norfolk and Suffolk, just again helping those facilitators to do the best job they can for their farmers.
So we've come out into this landscape with a low sun shining down, a beautiful blue sky now, and on our left is a very old woodland, it looks like, pretty coppiced as well in the past, quite big tree trunks now, on the edge of this ground, which is marshy and boggy, and you say is peaty. It's quite a distinct landscape, this conservation grazing, isn't it?
I mean, when the cattle are on it, I feel like I've stepped back historically to sort of the 18th century, because it's just so untouched by human hands, really. This has been an absolute godsend this year, because the peat holds the moisture, the grass has kept growing, so where I used to graze my cattle, I mean, I was looking at those fields and I would have been pulling my hair out, you know.
This year, with the drought.
Yeah, the drought, the grass wouldn't have grown. I'd have been feeding winter food, you know, July, August, September.
Sarah, you've not just been someone who's working with farmers in their cluster groups. You've also written books, haven't you?
I have.
And you're pretty sporty as well.
Yeah. So I used to work for the International Hockey Federation, and when the Great Britain women won gold back in 2016 at the Rio Olympics, I was lucky enough to be totally involved in that whole process. And myself and a colleague, Richard Stainthorpe, wrote a story. It's called The History Makers, my passion project, if you like, or the book that really I'm very, very excited about is the one that is coming out probably in the next couple of months or so, Home is Where the Herd Is. And it's the story of how this herd started and I guess some of the principles that I've used to develop the herd. I sort of like to think of it as a modern day James Herriot crossed with a, I don't know, a beef handler's manual.
So these are very different sides of you, aren't they? Mm. You write with verve and energy. And yet, what you really like doing is just stroking the animals and brushing them and calming everything down. I have to say, yin and yang, yes. A little balance there going on.
As a sports journalist, it was all about the here and now. And it took me quite a long time to get out of that immediacy. I was probably a complete pain to the people I worked with on the cluster groups, because farming isn't about the immediacy. It's about the next year, the next season, the next 5 years, the next 10 years. Even now we're talking about the next 30 years. So this person who was coming in and saying, right, I need to interview you and get your story on our website, and I need to get this grant in, I need to do it all by yesterday, that wasn't quite the rhythm that I needed to be finding. What I've discovered with the cattle is there is no pushing rhythm of nature. And I think it's had a, strange as it may sound, it has had a knock-on effect on me, because suddenly when I come down here and I'm brushing the cattle, I haven't got a deadline. I haven't got somebody waiting to publish something or anything like that. All I've got is actually a load of cows who all want a brush, which actually takes a really, really long time. It's slowing yourself down to the rhythm of the land and the rhythm of nature, and understanding that if you look at the grass and urge it to grow, it won't grow. You have to wait for it to grow.
Shall we let them out?
Let's let them out.
So it's just unlocking the gate, pulling it back. And there they go. And you can tell they're quite excited to be out, aren't they, into the bigger area. So what are they... they have gone for...
So this is the first bale of silage, which the vast majority at the moment are hanging around.
They are.
However, the smarter ones have noticed that there's a second bale up
further on.
Further on. They're all heading off there, but the... The belt of Galloway has deviated and is running with great excitement towards the hay. So
it's like a little race. Are you commentating?
Yes. So effectively,
she is charging the hay bale, isn't she?
And that's her little calf following her. So when I said about, you know, intergenerational, now that's Stormy the Bull
playing with it. They turned it right over. He's doing a better job than we were of rolling it down the hill. You were right to leave it whole.
Oh, yeah, they love playing with it. Teaching, the little calves have gone up there now, and they're like, oh, look what Uncle Stormy's just done. Or in that one's case, look what Dad's just done. And then we've got another young bullock who's now... there we go. You know what I said about those calm wagyu? Over there, we've got all the mothers gathered like a little bit of a coffee morning around one bale. Then we've got the kids, and they're doing exactly the same thing, but they're together around another bale.
And then you've got the boys.
That's the boys.
That's the boys on the other kimchi. Did you ever think, age five, you know, when you were helping your dad, that you would ever have your own, your very own herd?
I think when I was aged five, absolutely, because when you're aged five, the world is a complete possibility, isn't it? And particularly when I was living in London or Cambridge, of course I wouldn't have thought that. But even then, I mean, in Cambridge, I lived on the edge of Midsummer Common, the cattle graze there, and I would be the one who'd be out in the mornings sort of chatting to those cattle. So I always knew that there was a thing. But I must admit, even when I had two little Dexters and I was sort of leaning on the gate and doing my best farmer impression, I don't think I thought the two little Dexters would lead to this.
It's just such a heartwarming thing to see these beautiful animals really at peace, enjoying their food in the sunshine.
I mean, what I love is the interaction. So that little animal's just walked over there, and his younger self is looking back at him, eating a bit of hay, learning from him. I mean, that's natural living, isn't it? And it is just really, really cool.
On Your Farm was presented and produced by Anna Hill. It's a BBC Audio Bristol production for Radio 4. Let's take a look now at the weather. Let's say good morning to Simon King.
Neil, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. The weather remains pretty unsettled over the next few days. And of course, we've had a lot of rainfall so far this year. So people are obviously asking, when is it all going to change? Well, there are some signs now that as we go through later into next week, colder air is going to filter in from the north. And with that colder northerly wind, it does bring something sunnier, but also just cold enough for the potential of some snow showers for some. So stay tuned to the forecast for the details on that as we get closer to the later stages of next week. But for today, in southwest England and Wales, we've got a few showers around this morning. Those turning quite heavy in southwest England currently. A few mist patches around as well. Showers will become more numerous, I think, into the afternoon. But equally, this afternoon, there'll also be some breaks in the cloud to bring some sunny spells in between those showers, and temperatures getting to about 9 to 11 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, quite a bit of cloud, some early mist and fog, a few bright spells, but that's going to fill in with a lot of cloud. And staying dry for many, but there are a couple of showers around already this morning, and we could see further showers moving into the Midlands and eastern England in particular this afternoon, highs of 10 to 12 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, quite murky this morning. Overcast skies, some mist patches, some spots of drizzle around as well. Scattered showers will head in later this afternoon, highs of 8 to 10 Celsius. And for Northern Ireland, a bit misty this morning as well, but some clearer spells, bit of sunshine for much of the morning. It will turn cloudier later, and a few showers in eastern areas, highs of 7 to 9 degrees. And for Scotland today, well, it's a pretty wet start, especially around eastern Scotland, where we've got some heavy rain at the moment. The rain is going to gradually ease, but it will remain overcast for much of Scotland into the afternoon. Still some areas of rain and drizzle, and temperatures of 7 to 10 degrees Celsius.
Many thanks, Simon King. We learn more about the theology in the documentary Apocalypse in the Tropics, a story of religion and right-wing politics set in Brazil, when Ed Staton presents Sunday at 10 past 7.
In 2019, we began investigating the disappearance of Dr. Ruja Ignatova.
I believe we are a very special network.
A scammer who stole billions from investors around the world.
Number one cryptocurrency globally.
She's on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And now we have some unmissable updates.
She has money, and when you have money, you have power.
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as the hunt for the missing crypto queen continues. Listen first on BBC Sounds.
BBC News at 7 o'clock on Sunday, the 8th of February. Good morning, this is Lisa Costello. Foreign Office sources say officials will review the payoff given to Lord Mandelson when he was sacked as the UK's ambassador in Washington. Millions of Japanese people are braving cold weather to vote in a general election that was called with just 2 weeks' notice. Three incidents of sabotage on the railways in northern Italy are being linked to the opening of the Winter Olympics. Foreign Office sources say officials are reviewing a payoff given to Lord Mandelson after he was sacked as ambassador to the US, which could be worth about £40,000. The peer was dismissed in September over his relationship with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Emails released by the US Justice Department last month suggest he passed information to Epstein when he was serving in Gordon Brown's cabinet. Police are investigating allegations of misconduct in a public office. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment, but BBC News understands his position is that he has not acted in any way criminally and that he was not motivated by financial gain. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The review was announced following fresh details about Lord Mandelson's contact with Jeffrey Epstein in the latest tranche of the Epstein files and after the launching of a separate police investigation. The government has said that Lord Mandelson's payoff was in line with legal advice it had received and normal civil service practice. But Lord Mandelson's appointment was hardly run-of-the-mill, so a review of the settlement will be designed to reduce the potential political toxicity of paying him to leave his post. Number 10 sources have suggested that Lord Mandelson shouldn't await the review and either pay the money back or give it to a charity which supports victims. The Sunday Times has reported that the payment was likely to be the equivalent of 3 months' salary. The BBC has established that this would be in the region of £40,000. Lord Mandelson's lawyers have been approached for comment.
Millions in Japan are voting in a snap election called just 2 weeks ago. Japan's first female Prime Minister, Sanae Takaichi, is hoping that her personal popularity can overturn ill feeling towards her governing party. Shaima Khalil reports from outside a polling station in Tokyo.
Voters have braved heavy snowfall across Japan to head to the polls, with concern that the freezing conditions could affect turnout. Sanai Takaichi is betting on her personal popularity, hoping to deliver a clear mandate for the long-governing but deeply unpopular Liberal Democratic Party. The LDP has been tainted by financial scandals, which cost her predecessor his job and led to the party losing control of both chambers of Japan's parliament last year. But with just over 3 months in office, she's managed to distance herself from the party's image by focusing on diplomacy and cultivating a big social media following.
An American news anchor whose mother went missing from her home has told the people who are thought to have kidnapped her that she's willing to meet their ransom demands. Savannah Guthrie's 84-year-old mother, Nancy, disappeared a week ago from her home in Arizona, and a ransom note sent to media organisations reportedly demanded millions of dollars in Bitcoin in return for her safe release. From Tucson, David Willis reports.
The co-anchor of America's most popular TV morning show, Savannah Guthrie, has been caught up in a saga as bizarre as it is harrowing. 2 days after her mother disappeared from her home in an affluent suburb of Tucson, the celebrity news website TMZ received an email demanding millions of dollars in Bitcoin in return for Nancy Guthrie's release. Savannah Guthrie and her brother and sister chose to speak directly to whoever wrote the ransom note, and in a video posted on social media, they requested evidence their mother was still alive. Last night, having apparently received such proof, they posted again, this time saying they were willing to pay the ransom.
We received your message, and we understand. We beg you now to return our mother to us so that we can celebrate with her. This is the only way we will have peace. This is very valuable to us, and we will pay.
Local law enforcement has yet to comment on the developments. Last week, a spokesman said no suspects or vehicles connected to the case had been located.
The government is bringing in changes to apprenticeships in England, which it says are crucial for economic growth. The duration of courses will be cut to as little as 3 months, and thousands of young people will be fast-tracked into what ministers say will be high-quality jobs. Carl Cullinane from the Sutton Trust, a charity that seeks to improve social mobility, welcomed the move to get more young people into training, but warned that opportunities needed to be delivered effectively.
Accelerating the approval process can be great at generating new opportunities, but we cannot sacrifice quality at the expense of speed. These opportunities must have great on-the-job training, and that young people are getting the skills they need to develop their careers in the long term and not just in the short term.
The parents of two teenage sisters who were unlawfully killed in the Hillsborough disaster are launching a campaign to change official court records surrounding the circumstances of their children's deaths. Trevor and Jenny Hicks's daughters, Sarah and Vicky, were among 97 Liverpool fans who died as a result of the crush in Sheffield in 1989. Initially, police said the girls died without prolonged suffering. Later, proceedings established that wasn't true, but there's currently no mechanism to record the change on court documents. The authorities in northern Italy say they believe that three incidents of suspected sabotage affecting railway lines might have been linked to the first official day of competition at the Winter Olympics. The damage caused disruption for thousands of travellers. Our World News correspondent Joe Inwood reports.
A small cabin set alight near Pesaro, electric cables severed in Bologna, and a rudimentary explosive found nearby. All three incidents were discovered by the Italian authorities within a few hours of each other. There were some delays to the state-run rail network. Italy's transport minister called them serious sabotage, most likely designed to disrupt the first full day of the Winter Olympics. Matteo Salvini compared them to similar attempts to sabotage the French rail network as Paris hosted the Summer Games. On Thursday, Italian authorities say they foiled a number of cyber attacks, which they blamed on Russia.
At the Winter Olympics in Italy, the veteran American skier Lindsey Vonn will be hoping to overcome a knee injury to win back the downhill title she last won in 2010. And the teenage British snowboarder Mia Brooks begins her campaign for a medal. Our sports correspondent Andy Swiss is following the games from Cortina.
The women's downhill skiing could provide the story of these Olympics. 16 years after she won the title, America's Lindsey Vonn is aiming to do it again. Now 41 years old, she had been in impressive form after coming back from retirement. But last week, her hopes seemed over when she suffered a serious knee injury in a crash. Remarkably, though, she's still going to compete and clocked the third fastest time in training yesterday. One of Britain's medal contenders, meanwhile, will make her debut here. 19-year-old Mia Brooks is hoping to become Britain's youngest Winter Olympic medalist for 78 years as she goes in qualifying in the women's big air snowboarding event.
Rugby union and Wales have had a poor start to their Six Nations campaign. They lost 48-7 to England at Twickenham. The Wales head coach, Steve Tandy, expressed his disappointment.
The scoreboard speaks for itself, and England are a ruthless team. But when we come away, we've spoken hard around our discipline and being better. And then four yellow cards later is probably really disappointing. Disappointed with the way we didn't get in the game. Even when we got close to the 22 or in the 22, we weren't accurate enough in round our game. So yeah, bitterly disappointed.
Earlier, Scotland lost 18-15 to Italy in Rome. Now for a look at the papers, and the Sunday Times says the payoff to Lord Mandelson after he was removed as ambassador to the US will likely add to the pressure on Keir Starmer. The Sunday Mirror headlines on the Labour heavyweight Lord Blunkett's message to the Prime Minister, get your act together. The Sun on Sunday's editorial says Keir can't shift this vetting scandal stench. According to the Sunday Telegraph, Keir is said to be devastated and considering his future. The paper adds that the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, has let it be known that he had not been in favour of appointing Lord Mandelson as ambassador. The Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, tells The Observer that it would be a mistake to oust Sir Keir. Football is a 90-minute game, he says. You wouldn't dream of saying in the 35th minute, because you're 2-0 down, we'll take all the players off and sack the manager. The Sunday Express says the Red Arrows may use foreign-built jets for the first time. It says government dither and delay in picking a replacement for the ageing British Hawk aircraft has tipped the balance to US firms. A spokesperson for the Ministry of Defence says no final procurement decisions have been made. The Express also carries pictures of a 15-foot gold sculpture of President Trump. It says the statue, dubbed Don Colossus, was commissioned by cryptocurrency entrepreneurs and backers of the president and depicts the moment he raised his fist after an assassination attempt in Pennsylvania in 2024. It's fool's gold, according to the Daily Star Sunday, which reports that the sculpture languishes unwanted in storage because the artist hasn't been paid in full. And that's the news and papers this morning.
Many thanks, Lisa Costello. Now on Radio 4 at 7:10, time for Sunday with Edward Sturton.
Welcome to Sunday. After a torrid week which has brought the Jeffrey Epstein affair to the heart of British politics, we'll explore the Christian perspective on the latest developments.
One thing that Mandelson's been accused of, for which I wouldn't condemn him, is maintaining a relationship with a convicted person. Christianity is a combination of rules, because we believe in the Ten Commandments, and mercy. And I'm not going to judge someone for having maintained a relationship with someone who went to prison.
Also in the programme, why Britain's Muslims are running out of space to bury their dead, and...
Sold! Congratulations! Thank you very much all for your bidding. That's 23,100,000.
How a drawing of a foot raised that huge sum at auction. Our email, as ever, sunday@bbc.co.uk. The Epstein files are proving to be the news resource that just keeps on giving, and we'll explore the moral dimension to the affair later in the programme. But one intriguing email exchange that's emerged reveals that in 2017, the financier and convicted paedophile was sent fragments of a cloth used to cover the Kaaba, also known as the House of God, in the Great Mosque of Mecca. We're joined by the Leicester Imam, Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra. Good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Tell us a little bit about the significance of the Kaaba and indeed of this cloth, the kiswa that covers it.
The Kaaba, otherwise also known as the cube in the English language, is the central focal point for Muslim worship. Muslims face in that direction wherever they are in the world, five times a day during the prayer. We believe it was built by the prophet Abraham, peace be upon him, and over time it became a center of pilgrimage. Surrounding countries began to send cloth to cover it because it was seen as an honor to do that. Cloth from Yemen, Egypt, and other places began to be sent, and that became a practice over time. And in modern days, we find a very ornate, decorated piece of cloth prepared at huge cost that is used to cover it out of honoring this special house of God.
And as I understand it, as pilgrims walk round the Kaaba, they handle the cloth. Is that right?
It is not a practice that is religiously sanctioned, but I can understand that there is a lot of emotion, there's a lot of special attachment to what is connected with the Kaaba, so pilgrims will want to touch it. There's also the issue of health and safety, so the guards will try and control the crowds, but there are special places where one is encouraged to attach themselves by the door of the Kaaba and cry to God for forgiveness. We've got one of the corners, the Yamani corner, which is very special. And so people will eventually want to touch it. So millions will touch it throughout the year.
Obviously, hugely significant sacred thing. And it's changed quite regularly, I think. Is that right?
It is changed annually. There's a wonderful ceremony that goes with it. The Kiswa is prepared throughout the year by more than 150 artisans. There's a huge embroidery work that is done to it with the verses from the Quran embroidered with silver and gold thread on it. So it is indeed something that everyone attached to it feels it's very, very special. It's a great honor to be part of that whole process of preparing and changing and draping the Kaaba with this beautiful ornate decorative cloth.
And that brings us to the revelations in the Epstein files, I suppose. I think they suggest that something like $11,000 were paid for three bits of the Kiswa. Does that surprise you?
So the Kiswa, this covering of the cloth, when it's changed annually, the authorities in Saudi Arabia will then cut it up into many, many pieces. Sometimes large pieces are left intact and given to museums, to institutions, to dignitaries, and several other kinds of people. And once those people have ownership of that, then it now is out of, if you like, the jurisdiction and control of what happens to it. And so many individuals have sold it. I have friends here in Leicester, many of whom have managed to purchase pieces of Kiswa and have framed it to put it in their living rooms. A friend of mine has quite a large collection. It's a sense of pride when visitors come, they show them, they let them touch it. Many will smell it because perfume is put on it. So it is a very, very sentimental and emotive time for people to come when they come across the piece of Kiswa.
So while it may be a surprise that Jeffrey Epstein wanted to buy some of it, it's not completely out of the ordinary, is it?
For some, it would be seen as a piece of artwork. For Muslims, anything attached to the House of God in Makkah becomes special just by association. It is known also for people to take their own pieces of cloth and just rub it on the Kaaba as they're going around it, with the belief that there's some sense of a blessing that will be transferred onto their own garment, onto their own piece of cloth. So this is a kind of attachment that Muslims have with association of the holy sanctuary in Makkah.
So are you shocked by what's happened?
Personally, because people do not have any proper policing of where these items will end up, sadly, it will end up with individuals like Epstein. But for Muslims, it will be something that they will be very disappointed about. Some will be hurt by this to say, how did this ever end up with an individual such as this?
Sheikh Moghra, thank you very much indeed for joining us. And because all this does, or the beginning of the story does fall within the purview of the Saudi authorities, we did ask them for a reaction, but we've so far heard nothing back.
Here it goes then. The Michelangelo at Christie's is sold. Congratulations. Thank you very much all for your bidding. That's $23,100,000.
A hammer price of more than $23 million, nearly £17 million. Quite a lot to pay for a small chalk drawing of a foot. but then the drawing is credited to Michelangelo, as we heard, and the foot is a study for the Sistine Chapel, famous for its magnificent frescoes and also as the place where popes, of course, are chosen. Jada Daman, a specialist in Old Masters at Christie's, was responsible for researching the picture, and I asked her to describe it.
This is a drawing executed in red chalk and is the drawing of a right foot. It's probably the right foot of a man, although maybe there is not much difference in the anatomy of the male foot versus the female foot, but is a preparatory study for a female figure, the figure of the Libyan Sibyl, on the Sistine ceiling painted by Michelangelo.
And as I understand it, the seller, when they approached Christie's, had no idea quite what it was.
This is correct. So the seller had the drawing on the back of the frame, and was a simple frame. There was a cardboard with written Michelangelo and a provenance, but nobody had paid attention in his family to the value or the truthfulness of this inscription.
And what did you at Christie's do to nail it down, to show that it was indeed a Michelangelo?
We received the photograph, and then we discussed among us specialists and established that was a high-quality drawing. We always want to look at them in person because photographs are not very reliable for artworks. So I traveled and visited the client, and I saw the drawing, and then I encourage him to bring it to New York so that we could do more research. And I started investigating. So first we did some analysis in a conservation center. And then we did a lot of art historical research and finally showed it to the experts on Michelangelo just to have their confirmation. And everyone agreed on the attribution.
That must have been, for you and certainly for the owner, that must have been quite a moment.
Yeah, it's been a very exciting process, step by step. And at the end, when we were able to pull all the elements together, everyone was excited and the owner was very excited, of course.
The Sistine Chapel is home to some of the great masterpiece works of Christian heritage.
Yes.
But you say this was at the foot, we think, of a Sibyl, which is a prophetess, I think, in the ancient world. What is a Sibyl doing in the Sistine Chapel?
Yes, the iconography of the Sistine ceiling is very elaborate. There are many figures and many elements, and it seems from what the sources say that actually Michelangelo conceived this whole program with great freedom from the Pope, and maybe with the help of a theologian. So in the Sistine Chapel, there are stories of the Old Testament in the ceiling, and then on the walls, there were already painting scenes of the life of Christ. So the Sibyl and the prophets, they are figures alternating, connecting the Old Testament of the ceiling with the New Testament that is illustrated on the walls.
I know it's very difficult to identify why an artwork has particular value, but does the fact that the chapel has been home, for example, to the election of so many popes mm-hmm. down the ages, does that add to the value, the monetary value of something like this?
Probably, yes. But also, the Sistine Chapel was built as a private chapel for the Pope. The first decoration of the ceiling was a plain blue sky with the stars. But then around 1504, a big crack came in the ceiling. That's why the Pope, Julius II, decided to repaint it. And Michelangelo program was so unconventional. That's also what makes this project and this study connected with this work very, very special and exceptional.
I'm going to ask my next question, expecting the answer no, but can you tell me who bought it?
No, I'm sorry, I can't.
Can you at least tell me whether the world will be able to see it or whether it's going to be kept quietly somewhere in a private collection?
I don't know. At this point, I don't know yet. We'll see.
Jada Daman from Christie's, tight-lipped there at the end. Muslim communities around the country are warning that they're running out of space to bury their dead. Nearly 80% of the 600,000 people who die each year in the United Kingdom are cremated. But that option is not viable for Muslims. Mohammed Omar chairs the National Burial Council, the umbrella organisation for Islamic burial. Good morning.
Morning to you.
Quick bit of theology first. Why is cremation out of the question for Muslims?
For us, basically, our religion teaches us that we should respect human beings and make sure that because the body was entrusted to you by God, make sure that you are buried in the manner which was being taught to us, and that's to bury a person and not to cremate. Cremation is something which we believe is not really respectful for the person who passes away, as the body is very sacrosanct to the Muslim community and similarly to other faiths as well.
And as I understand it, one of the reasons this issue is rising up the agenda is a demographic one, in the sense that lots of people who came to this country from Pakistan, from India and so forth, lots of people are reaching a certain age now.
That is correct. Our population is an aging population. And also there are demographic issues in the sense that before that, a number of people used to ensure that the bodies were repatriated back to where they came from, because there was really no, there was very little availability of space, or at least spaces for burial, which was in accordance with our Islamic requirements. So a number of them used to actually repatriate the bodies. They still do, but the numbers have reduced because a lot of them, the children, the younger generation, are saying that we don't want our parents or anybody else to be repatriated. We'd rather that they be buried over here so that we can go and visit them and we can pray for them. And that's one of the other reasons. Secondly, there are a number of cemeteries now available whereby the full Islamic requirements are adhered to, and people are feeling much more comfortable that they should be buried over here. And thirdly, as you've quite rightly stated, that the population of the Muslim community is an increasing population, and therefore space is going to be required, as we don't have any other alternative but to bury our loved ones.
You point out there are now some Muslim cemeteries available, but there have also been some quite high profile cases of attempts to build new cemeteries for Muslims being knocked back. What are the reasons usually for that?
I think the reasons for that is a number of them would be definitely in terms of the whether they would conform to the green belt requirements. One of the requirements of the green belt, cemetery is a permitted use in green belt, but then you also have to make sure that you are able to adhere to and conform to the various requirements you need for a green belt site in terms of openness, in terms to ensure that you do not have an impact on the local community. You have to make sure that the environment is taken place as well. And also, there's always going to be that particular element who is going to say that we don't want a cemetery in our backyard. So that you're always going to get that issue as well. And land is not really readily accessible. So one of the places you would want is an open space, a green space. And for us as Muslims, we would prefer virgin ground. And therefore, at times, you do find that some of these particular sites are right in some rural locations or in an area whereby there would be not many Muslim populations, and some of the locals may not really see it in a favorable manner. But just let me assure you that anybody who applies for any cemetery of any religion has to go through so many vigorous requirements, which all the environment and every other aspect of it needs to be adhered to before they are even given planning permission. So it is an uphill process, and it's difficult. And this is one of the challenges which new cemeteries will face.
And what does the law say about all this? I mean, is there any legal responsibility on councils or the government to provide burial space?
Unfortunately, I mean, when we first came into this particular area, we were quite shocked to say that there is no legal responsibility for a council to provide a burial space. However, it has always been a moral requirement for councils to ensure that they, for the deceased to be buried or cremated for that matter. And this is one of the challenges which the Law Commission, which has been set up by the government, is exploring. We feel very strongly that there should be a requirement, a legal requirement by the councils to ensure that they provide a means of to try and ensure that the person who's passed away needs to be buried or cremated. After all, they are the ones who paid everything in their life. They've paid the taxes. They've paid. So why should we not give the dignity to the person who's passed away?
We must leave it there, but that's a fascinating point. And just a message to our listeners, if any of you have personal experience of the difficulty of finding burial space in this country, do get in touch with us, sunday@bbc.co.uk. The BAFTA Awards take place 2 weeks from today. The list of nominees has been published, and one of those to make it through is a documentary called Apocalypse in the Tropics. It's a story of religion and right-wing politics set in Brazil, and it focuses on the rule of Jair Bolsonaro, who was the country's president from 2019 until 2023, when he was replaced by President Lula da Silva. The trailer for the film begins with images of Brasilia, Brazil's purpose-built capital city.
This city was designed as a vision of Brazil's future. And the cement that held it together was a faith. Not in God, but instead in the equally abstract ideas of progress and democracy. In the last 40 years, evangelicals have grown from 5 to more than 30% of Brazil's population. A rapid religious shift molded into an unprecedented political force.
Petra Costa directed the film, and I asked her about the impact of that rise in evangelical Christianity.
That happened in the 70s and 80s, particularly. It began, and I think there are many elements associated with it. One was the migration from rural areas, where the evangelical faith adapted much more quickly to this new reality. And with the prosperity of theology that was much more in line with people's lives. And also what we found out in our documentary through our investigator, Nicolás Iglesias, was that there was U.S. funding sending missionaries to Brazil as part of a Cold War project to advance capitalism and fight against the threat of socialism, which they saw present in the Catholic Church in liberation theology.
And we should say, when you talk about prosperity theology, that's the idea that being a good Christian gets you rich.
Exactly.
You mentioned liberation theology and the Catholic Church, and just by way of background, it's worth saying, isn't it, that in the 70s and early 80s, the leadership of the Catholic Church in Brazil, I'm thinking of people like Cardinal Arns, the Archbishop of Sao Paulo, were very important opponents of the military regime and, you know, broadly speaking, we would say in terms of social questions, very much on the left.
Yes, that was a shift in the Catholic Church, which at first supported the military coup in 64, and then grew a huge part of it turned against it. As part of this movement as well in Latin America called liberation theology, which asked for an approach to the poor and to a theology that was more in line with political awakening of the oppressed.
In your documentary, coming up to the present day, or at least recent times, you, I think, broadly argue or suggest that the change in politics brought about by that shift to the evangelicals is very closely linked to the presidency of President Bolsonaro, who became the leader of the country in 2019.
What we see is that the evangelicals supported and aligned with Lula in 2002 and throughout the 13 years that the Workers' Party was in power. When Dilma was impeached, they disaligned and went against her. And then when the far right starts to be born in the world and in Brazil, incorporated through Bolsonaro, they see the opportunity of having their own messiah, a candidate that was really their own and that gave them more than any other president before in terms of tax breaks and access to power. And a marriage that was never seen before really happened between religious fundamentalism and the far right, a marriage that in the United States had been developing since the 70s, here developed in a much faster speed from 2013 to 18.
Can I ask you something about the title of your film? It includes the word apocalypse, which is a very striking and obviously a word that has great religious significance. Why did you choose that word?
When we were living through the first years of Bolsonaro's presidency, when I began making this film, at first it really felt we were living through the apocalypse with 700,000 deaths, half of them avoidable. This denialism of the president to human life was very disheartening. During COVID, was very disheartening. And apocalypse began to be used by everyone. And when we were filming in churches, most of the songs were about the apocalypse. And I started to understand that this theology of religious fundamentalism, evangelical fundamentalism, is very motivated and has added as its genesis apocalyptic theology. The idea that the faster the world will end, the faster will come the second coming of Jesus Christ. So one pastor we spoke to said, Bolsonaro is creating chaos, but that is good because it will accelerate the return of Jesus. That was so despairing. It's also called the theology of despair for that reason, because they're not using Christianity to think how to make the world a better place, but actually to accelerate its end. But then I also discovered the opposite meaning, or the real meaning of the word apocalypse, which is not end of the world, but a revelation. And for me, the revelation that this film and this journey gave was to really look at the complexity beneath the far right growth and thought.
Finally, just returning to where we began, I think Brazil is still the most populous Catholic country in the world, something like 130 million Catholics. You pointed out that there's been an enormous increase in the number of evangelicals. How do you see that in the future? Do you think that trend of more and more people becoming evangelicals is going to continue?
In the last census, there was a decrease in the growth. Malafaia, the pastor we portrayed, said he thought they would be 30% by now, which is not the case. There's also an increase of evangelicals who are no longer of any denomination. What we know now is that most of the prominent evangelical leaders continue to be aligned with the far right.
Petra Costa talking to me earlier. You're listening to Sunday. The time is approaching 25 to 8. Still to come in the programme, the London Gurdwara giving help and support to families suffering from domestic violence.
I thought if I'd report him to the police, I'd lose my children, because they were being exposed to the violence as well. I had no clue of where to contact, who to contact, solicitors, police.
This coming week marks the 70th anniversary of a religious broadcasting milestone, the first portrayal of Jesus on British television. On the 12th of February 1956, the BBC broadcast the first episode in an eight-part series called Jesus of Nazareth. It went out in a children's slot.
The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
Then hear thou from the heavens, that all people on earth may know that this house which I have built is called by thy name. That is what the wise Solomon said about the temple of God, that it should be a house of prayer for all people. Why, masters, no earthly father shuts the door against his child, whatever bad thing he may have done. Is it likely that our heavenly father would show less mercy?
Now, by the broadcast historian Paul Hayes, who's been researching the story for the history of the BBC website. Good morning.
Good morning.
Since we're talking on the radio, I'm going to stick up for the wireless for a moment, because the very first broadcast attempt of this was actually on the Home Service, wasn't it? It was Dorothy Sayers' The Man Born to Be King, which caused a huge stir at the time.
Yes, and in many ways paved the way for the writer and producer of this television version, Jesus of Nazareth, Joy Harrington. She was very influenced by Sayers' work, particularly in the scripting of the dialogue. And she has this phrase she uses in a memo about how Sayers was able to give the disciples properly masculine dialogue. She talks about how in the children's, the school's broadcasting versions that had been on the radio before, the disciples speak like school children, not like men. But she thought Sayers' scripts had avoided that. So it was very much a template, very much something she looked to. She went back and read the scripts, Harrington, and was very heavily influenced by that.
And amazing thing to say today, but at that stage, if you did represent Jesus, certainly on stage, you required the permission of the Lord Chamberlain.
Yeah, and again, this was something where the radio series in the 1940s had paved the way. They were quite confident they didn't need the Lord Chamberlain's permission for radio in the 40s, but they had consulted him anyway. And by the time we get to this version in 1956, it's not so much a case of whether they could do it. They were quite comfortable about that. It was more how they did it. For instance, could they script dialogue for Jesus that wasn't from the Bible? That was one of the issues they debated during the pre-production period.
And they did, presumably. Quite difficult to do it entirely from the Bible, I would imagine.
That was Joy Harrington, the writer and producer's thinking behind it. You simply couldn't do that. You couldn't do just a televised version of biblical scenes. It wouldn't be a realistic drama in that way, which is what they wanted to do.
And how did it go? I mean, did it cause controversy, or how did it go down with the audience?
It seems to have gone down very well. Certainly with the critics, it went down very well in the newspapers. The only real criticisms there were of it seemed to be that some people did find it a little bit staged, a little bit insipid. But in the BBC files at the wonderful BBC Written Archives Centre at Caversham in Berkshire, where the history of the BBC is chronicled, one of the great cultural resources we have in
fantastic
this country.
Fantastic place. Spent many
wonderful
hours there.
Place, yeah, yeah. One of the clippings they've kept in those files is from a Scottish newspaper called The People's Journal, where they got a range of verdicts from viewers across Scotland. And yeah, there's an interesting range. There's one reverend in Inverness saying it is not in keeping with the teaching of the Bible. Mr. Milne in Dundee says, I think it's very wrong. When it was first announced on this Sunday, I switched the set off. But other people saying how they thought this was very appropriate for the 20th century. This was how children would learn about the story of Jesus, and it was the right thing to do. And then a few in a kind of middle ground. One person says that they weren't too sure. But one lady, Mrs. Kennedy from Dunfermline, says, the first episode was very good, but I really don't know what to think. Even seeing Christ's name on the screen was strange.
Gosh. And in the clip we heard there, Jesus was played by Richard Palmer, but I think for most of the series, it was played by Tom Fleming. And it's an intriguing footnote, that, isn't it? Because he, of course, became one of the great BBC announcers covering coronations and Trooping the Colour and that sort of thing.
Yes, but he was an actor at the time. He had appeared in various television dramas, so he was a bona fide actor. But there's a sort of implication. It's not outright stated in the files, but there is a kind of unspoken thing that he was almost chosen as much for his religious qualifications. He was the son of a Baptist minister. He'd done religious broadcasting. He'd appeared in the epilogue on television talking about his faith. So I think he was seen as well as being a good actor, a safe bet from that perspective as well.
And, of course, we should remember that all of this back then was done live, wasn't it? Or as live, or actually live?
Not quite. There was some pre-filming done. The BBC had just taken over Ealing Studios, and they did some pre-filming there. And they did some pre-filming in Palestine as well. They took Tom Fleming over to Palestine and did some scenes like The Temptation in the Wilderness and that kind of thing. But the main bulk of the episodes, they would play these film inserts into, yes, live on air, which was a dicey process at the time. There's one memo you can see in the article we've got at bbc.co.uk/history of the BBC, where they had to replace one actor 2 days before transmission because the actor playing Peter had fallen ill. And in episode 4, the controller of television was very upset that Tom Fleming actually dried. He forgot his line, and so he had to take a prompt. And usually they had what they called a cutout key, so you'd mute it when there was a prompt needed. But the cutout key was broken, so you heard this loud prompt being given to Tom Fleming in episode 4.
Paul, we're live, and because of that, I'm going to have to stop you now. But what a great note to end on. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you.
Domestic abuse is, of course, a terrible experience for women and children to suffer in any circumstances, but there are particular challenges when it takes place among families going through the process of settling in this country, with things like visa applications, financial support, and the legal system to navigate. Asik Gudwara in London has developed a scheme to help women and children like that. Suki Heyer reports from the Sri Guru Singh Sabha Gudwara in Southall.
I'm in a boardroom-style office near Heathrow, and I'm greeted by what looks like a normal family gathering. But while the children play, the mothers, 6 of them, share a harrowing bond. Every woman here is a survivor. They have been beaten mentally and physically by their husbands. Ramanpreet, Haditikava and S. Kaur share their story with me.
Unfortunately, my daughter was just 4 months old when he abandoned us, and he ceased all the contact with me and my daughter. I was not having any friend circle, any family. I was dependent on him for everything.
I thought if I'd report him to the police, I'd lose my children because they were being exposed to the violence as well. And my little one was 1 year old and my older one was 4 year old. So I was just coming off post maternity and I just did not have the courage to face him and even the legal system. I had no clue of where to contact, who to contact, solicitors, police, everything from scratch. I think because of Azra Welfare, because of them, I reported. Otherwise, I would have stayed in the abusive relationship.
I had no mental support and my husband told me to leave the house and leave my daughter behind. I stayed in that situation for a year. They brainwashed my daughter to stay away from me. I don't know what they said to her.
They all came to Britain with dreams of sharing a happy life with their new husbands. Instead, they suffered violence and mental torture. This is where Jazz Shergill stepped in.
We used to get signpost lock cases from the Gudra because people see the Gudra first door to help. And we had a woman, for example, I think last year, she was sleeping in the Southall Park. She was abandoned by her husband and she had a 2 to 3 year old, I think 3 year old daughter with her. So she went to Gurdwara, obviously got to us. We spoke to immigration services, managed to get her back within 2 days to India, and she also got £6,000 from immigration, you know, the volunteer return.
In 2022, as a victim of domestic abuse herself, Jazz founded the community interest group Asra, which means hope. A year later, she enlisted the help of the Sri Guru Singh Sabha Gurdwara in Southall to provide housing and food. So far, they have rescued more than 60 women and children.
Gurdwara is the hub of the community. It's where people go when they're in desperate need.
Harmeet Singh was on the Gurdwara committee at the time. He felt it was their duty to show compassion.
And that name, Asra, hope, when all means are failed, where do you go to? You go to the Guru. And so the Gurdwara has a moral, legal, a dharmic duty to always take care of anyone and everyone. And aside from things like education, langar, social welfare is one of the most important things that Gurdwara can do to support anyone, regardless of them being sick or non-sick. So it was important for us to find any way we can to help these usually women. And the Asra project was a great way to do it. In my time at the Sabha, we were fortunate. The Sabha is well-resourced. And the congregation recognised the amazing support this was doing. So they actually actively wanted to support it. They wanted to donate towards it. So it's a catch-22. Provide the support. Yes, it will cost. But people want to. When people see the positive impact it's happening, they will come forward and actually support it.
Harmeet encourages all faiths to help. But why is this necessary? Why do these women, many of whom are waiting on residency applications, have to rely on a religious institution for shelter? For them, the bureaucracy is overwhelming. Some women don't fit the criteria for government funds. They told us they find the system impossible to navigate alone. It's apparent that without Asra and the Gurdwara, many of these women would be homeless or forced back into the arms of their abusers just to stay here. Haditi, who we heard from earlier, has been in the country nearly 2 decades, but is still caught up in a legal battle.
It is a broken system and it is way too expensive for a normal, ordinary person to hire a solicitor or legal help. Especially you're mentally broken down, because if you'd seen me 2 years ago, all I was doing was just crying. I couldn't come out of that cycle of emotional drama and social abuse and the fear of me being out and what's the society going to say? How is my workplace going to say? And I think at one point, even at my workplace, I was being kicked out because my performance went down.
Today, however, there is a break in the clouds. Ramanpreet has brought a cake for the group. She has just received notice of her right to stay in the UK.
Ramanpreet ending that report by Suki Haya. We return now to the Epstein files. The story is all over the Sunday papers, just as it's been all over the front pages all week. Sunday Times has PM's chief of staff on brink of resignation because of his role in Lord Mandelson's appointment to Washington. The Observer front page declares donors tell Starmer time is running out. And the Sunday Telegraph reports, Lammy, I warn Starmer about Mandelson. Politicians, including the Prime Minister, have reacted to what's emerged with shock and anger. Many other people have greeted the story with a shrug of the shoulders, as if to say, this is the kind of thing we expect from politicians. When I spoke to Tim Stanley, a Catholic writer for the Daily Telegraph, I asked him which group he fell into.
I'm going to be very Mandelson and go third way and say both. I am, of course, appalled, but this is also what I've always suspected. And I think this is the tip of the iceberg. First of all, nothing's been proven. We haven't yet demonstrated that Mandelson passed on things that led to someone profiteering. So we haven't yet nailed him on insider trading. But if such a thing did go on, a lot of that happens in Congress, and they make a lot of money out of it, to the point that some traders actually shadow the accounts of Congress members because they seem so mysteriously brilliant at trading on the stock market. So I am both disgusted, but also totally unsurprised.
Just to pick up on what you said about Peter Mandelson, we should, of course, add that he has maintained that he did nothing wrong. But because of his involvement and because of his past, this is in some senses a very particularly Labour Party scandal. Can you just tell us where you think it touches the Labour Party particularly and what it reveals about the way it works?
It's very significant that Mandelson was part of the Blair Project. And the Blair Project was about reconciling Labour to market economics. So the quote for which he's perhaps most famous is, "I am intensely relaxed about people getting filthy rich." Mandelson added, and it's often forgotten, "so long as they pay their taxes." But that was the deal with the devil, if you see capitalism as the devil, that Labour made in the 1990s. They were going to stop judging people or penalising them for getting rich. And you could argue that it's a trade-off, that that worked for them politically and worked for the country economically, but it came with a big moral compromise. And many on the left of the Labour Party see this scandal as not just about one man or the Prime Minister's poor judgment, but about how the left sold its soul to rapacious greed. And that this is really the long tail of Blairism.
Okay, so that's the moral dimension, if you like, from the Labour perspective. What about the bigger picture? To what extent do you think this is a reflection of a wider problem with British politics more generally?
It's a problem about a lack of transparency. It's a problem about elites. It's a problem of the boys' club network that still runs much of this country. It's a problem of a politics where we don't really speak about virtue anymore. We don't do it because we're nervous of getting caught out. We don't want to be seen to be judging people. But it also means that we perhaps don't assert certain standards often enough. And it's obvious that in private, they're not being expected of some of our politicians. You know, one thing that Mandelson's been accused of, for which I wouldn't condemn him, is maintaining a relationship with a convicted person. Christianity is a combination of rules, because we believe in the Ten Commandments, and mercy, because Jesus famously said, "Forgive them, Father, for they do not know what they do." And I'm not going to judge someone for having maintained a relationship with someone who went to prison. It's the fact that Mandelson appears to have celebrated his release, indulged his baser instincts and tastes, and is accused of leaking important documents and potentially helping someone to make money. So I think all of this scandal for me comes back to the loss of a sense of a Christian ethic, which can apply, by the way, to Muslims who have very strict rules over things like charity. They can apply to Jews who have a fantastic tradition of things like debt forgiveness. All major religions have ethics around money and around sex. And it feels as though some of those ethics have been weakened in the last few years because we've all become a bit too sophisticated, too jaded, and we're not insisting upon the highest standards in public life.
And who do you think can insist on their values? Do you think religious leaders are in a position to make that sort of case today?
Very difficult for them because churches, of course, have been tainted by everything I've discussed. Crimes of sex and money and of cover-up. So they've just lost some of their legitimacy in the public's eyes. That said, I do find it strange when churches are very quick to talk about matters of poverty, which they should, but they're less willing to delve into this kind of personal politics. But heavens, if there was ever a moment for a dash of Victorian morality, It's right now.
It has been a good week for those who believe slightly scary things about the way the world works, hasn't it? I mean, those who think, for example, that elites, usually male elites, behave in this way, that there's links between powerful people that are used in a corrupting manner, they can point to what's happened and say, we're right.
They can do. And that's probably because, in some instances, they are right. Some online fantasies have not been proven. Epstein, Mandelson, Trump, various other people accused are all white males. This is not a very woke conspiracy, if it is going on. It doesn't involve the kind of people who we normally obsess about in the UK, like Muslims, for instance. But of course, it encourages people to read those things into it. But I think it's true. I think, broadly speaking, politics is a conspiracy against the public. I'm sorry if I come across as a cynic here, but it comes from having covered politics for so long. That's the kind of people who are drawn to politics. It attracts a certain type, many of them sociopaths and narcissists, many of them amoral, and they can form a kind of a trade union among themselves to protect each other. And the ultimate antidote to that is transparency, free press, and democracy. I mean, you ask who should be holding people to account. It's the voters. And if people do this sort of thing, then it's incumbent upon the voters to please, please don't vote them back into office, whether they're Conservative or Labour or Republican or Democrat.
It's also true, isn't it, that this suggests that very often powerful, as you put it, white men don't care very much about women.
No. That's a very sad part of this, isn't it? The way in which women are spoken of as commodities, and who also, throughout this story, don't seem to have a central role except either as courtesans or people who arrange sex. They're sort of social facilitators. It's really striking again. You know, I'm on the political right. There's a lot of critique of woke that I embrace. But we were told things had gone too far. There was too much feminism. Women were taking over. Well, the biggest political scandal of this moment hardly involves any women, though having said that, the one person who has gone to jail for it is a woman.
Reference there, of course, to Ghislaine Maxwell. That was Tim Stanley. One email before we go. Anthony John is a fan of Tom Fleming for his portrayal of Jesus in the first portrayal of Jesus on British television we discussed earlier. He says, as a small boy, I recall his portrayal as being eminently holy and his wonderful voice enhanced the whole representation of the Bible story. Emily Buchanan will be in this chair next week. Do listen then from me. Goodbye for this Sunday.
Sunday was produced by Bada Arthur Ibrahim and Katie Booth. Now the All Creatures Great and Small actress, Rachel Shenton, makes the Radio 4 appeal on behalf of Deaf Kids International.
My dad lost his hearing suddenly following cancer treatment when I was just 12 years old. For my dad, simple conversations became impossible and he retreated from his family and friends. For me, it opened my eyes to just how much I took communication for granted, and it inspired me to learn British Sign Language and then write an Oscar-winning film about a young girl whose world changes after learning to sign. But sadly, not all deaf people or children have support or access to sign language, and that's why I'm proud to be an ambassador for Deaf Kids International. The charity works across Africa and Asia, where deafness is often underdiagnosed and where some parents don't even know their own child is deaf. Others may hear myths that deaf children are cursed. Deaf children can also remain non-verbal and poorly educated, even in their own sign languages, which can lead to them becoming extremely vulnerable. Take 10-year-old Amir from Pakistan, whose name's been changed for protection reasons. Amir was born deaf and, like my dad, found communicating difficult. For many years he ran errands for his family, to and from the local store, where he was repeatedly bullied and roughed up by the shopkeeper. This made Amir feel scared, hurt, and worthless. And like so many deaf children, he didn't know how to respond. That's until, with the support of his mum, he enrolled onto Deaf Kids Defenders programme. Using animated computer games featuring deaf superheroes, alongside workshops with specialist teachers, the programme helps deaf children learn how to spot danger and gives them the confidence to speak up. Thanks to the programme, Amir was able to say stop to the shopkeeper by using strong body gestures and could immediately sign to his parents and teachers whenever he felt unsafe. Now Amir no longer runs errands to the store and the shopkeeper no longer torments him. As Amir says, even though he's deaf, No one should ever think he's weak. But for every emir, there are thousands more deaf children at risk of abuse. And that's why I'm asking for your help today, so deaf children can find their own superpowers and be safe. £50 can enrol a deaf child onto a DK Defenders programme, and £200 can train 8 teachers to deliver the programme in schools across Africa and Asia. To donate, search online for BBC Radio 4 Appeal or call 0800 404 8144. Or write a cheque and send it to Free Post, BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Please mark the back of your envelope, Deaf Kids International. Thank you so much.
Rachel Shenton. The calls are free from landlines and from mobiles, and you can find all the details for giving online if you search for BBC Radio 4 Appeal. Remember, if you are a UK taxpayer and if you want Deaf Kids International to collect the gift aid on your donation, please include an email or postal address so they can send you a gift aid declaration. Let's get a weather update now. Here's Simon King.
Neil, thank you so much indeed. Good morning. There is further rain in the forecast today, but I'm hopeful that there will be some lengthier dry spells compared to the last few days. So perhaps some more usable weather just to be out and about this afternoon, perhaps. But for Wales and southwest England, we've got some showers already, particularly heavy in the southwest of England. Those are going to become a bit more numerous as we go into this afternoon. But equally, there will be some dry spells with a bit of sunshine developing between those showers as well. Maximum temperatures getting up to about 9 to 11 degrees. For the Midlands, eastern and southeast England, some early mist and fog patches are clearing away. A few bright spells initially this morning, but those will tend to fill in with a bit of cloud. And while it will be dry for many, we will see showers, particularly for the Midlands and eastern England, where a few of those could be on the heavy side this afternoon. Highs of 10 to 12 Celsius. For northwest and northeast England, quite murky with some mist patches and some drizzle as well. Scattered showers will head in during the afternoon, maximum temperatures of about 8 to 10 degrees. And for Northern Ireland, a bit misty this morning, but there will be some clear spells and a bit of sunshine for much of the morning. Cloudier though later this afternoon, with a few showers, especially in the east, highs of 7 to 9 degrees. And across Scotland, well, it's been a wet start for the day. The rain especially heavy across eastern areas of Scotland, some hill snow over the ground. Now, the rain is going to gradually ease across many parts of Scotland, but it will stay overcast, damp and drizzly even throughout the afternoon. Some strong winds in the far northeast, temperatures of 7 to 10 degrees. But into next week, we are going to see further areas of rain pushing north and eastward across the UK, both on Monday, Tuesday as well. But there are some signs of changes later in the week as we switch to a northerly wind. That's a cleaner air direction, so more sunshine, or certainly sunnier than it's been recently, but it will be colder and there is the risk of some snow showers, particularly around coastal areas of the north and east.
And thanks, Simon King, with the weather. We're joined now by Paddy O'Connell for a word about Broadcasting House coming up in an hour. Morning, Paddy.
Hello, Neil, and good morning to you. Peter Mandelson's payoff as a US ambassador is under review, say Foreign Office sources, and David Lammy is the first cabinet minister reported to say he warned about appointing him as ambassador. Our live guest will be Lord Blunkett, who blames the kids in Downing Street. What have years of trouble at the top and scandal and failure done to us all? Andrew Marr and Dame Tanny Gray-Thompson contrast the British optimism of 2012 and the Jubilympics with a decade of doom. We join a walking group live in the rain and enjoy the news picks of Arlene Phillips dancing Dame, Mark Pugach, ITV rugby man, and Ashley Armstrong of the FT.
BBC News at 8 o'clock on Sunday the 8th of February. Good morning, this is Lisa Costello. Foreign Office sources say officials will review the payoff given to Lord Mandelson when he was sacked as the UK's ambassador in Washington. Millions of Japanese people are braving cold weather to vote in a general election that was called with just 2 weeks' notice. Three incidents of sabotage on the railways in northern Italy are being linked to the opening of the Winter Olympics. Foreign Office sources say officials are reviewing a payoff given to Lord Mandelson after he was sacked as ambassador to the US, which could be worth about £40,000. The peer was dismissed in September over his relationship with the sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Emails released by the US Justice Department last month suggest he passed information to Epstein when he was serving in Gordon Brown's cabinet. Police are investigating allegations of misconduct in a public office. Lord Mandelson has not responded to requests for comment, but BBC News understands his position is that he has not acted in any way criminally and that he was not motivated by financial gain. Here's our political correspondent, Ian Watson.
The review was announced following fresh details about Lord Mandelson's contact with Jeffrey Epstein in the latest tranche of the Epstein files and after the launching of a separate police investigation. The government has said that Lord Mandelson's payoff was in line with legal advice it had received and normal civil service practice. But Lord Mandelson's appointment was hardly run-of-the-mill, so a review of the settlement will be designed to reduce the potential political toxicity of paying him to leave his post. Number 10 sources have suggested that Lord Mandelson shouldn't await the review and either pay the money back or give it to a charity which supports victims. The Sunday Times has reported that the payment was likely to be the equivalent of 3 months' salary. The BBC has established that this would be in the region of £40,000. Lord Mandelson's lawyers have been approached for comment. On Wednesday, Parliament decided that ministers should release government files and electronic communications about Lord Mandelson before and during his appointment as ambassador to Washington. It's understood the exact payment and the reasons for making it will be made public as part of that process.
Millions in Japan are voting in a snap election called just 2 weeks ago. Japan's first female prime minister, Sanae Takeuchi, is hoping that her personal popularity can overturn ill feeling towards her governing party. Shaima Khalil reports from outside a polling station in Tokyo.
Voters have braved heavy snowfall across Japan to head to the polls, with concern that the freezing conditions could affect turnout. Sanae Takeuchi is betting on her personal popularity, hoping to deliver a clear mandate for the long-governing but deeply unpopular Liberal Democratic Party. The LDP has been tainted by financial scandals, which cost her predecessor his job and led to the party losing control of both chambers of Japan's parliament last year. But with just over 3 months in office, she's managed to distance herself from the party's image by focusing on diplomacy and cultivating a big social media following.
An American news anchor whose mother went missing from her home has told the people who are thought to have kidnapped her that she's willing to meet their ransom demands. Savannah Guthrie's 84-year-old mother, Nancy, disappeared a week ago from her home in Arizona, and a ransom note sent to media organisations reportedly demanded millions of dollars in Bitcoin in return for her safe release. Savannah Guthrie released a video on social media after saying she'd received proof that her mother was still alive.
We received your message, and we understand. We beg you now to return our mother to us so that we can celebrate with her. This is the only way we will have peace. This is very valuable to us, and we will pay.
Russia's Federal Security Service says a man suspected of shooting a senior general in Moscow last week has been arrested in Dubai. Russia's deputy head of military intelligence, Vladimir Alexeyev, was shot and wounded in Moscow on Friday. Reports on state media say a Russian man is being extradited. The Kremlin has blamed Ukraine for the shooting, which Kyiv denies. The government is bringing in changes to apprenticeships in England, which it says are crucial for economic growth. The duration of courses will be cut to as little as 3 months, and thousands of young people will be fast-tracked into what ministers say will be high-quality jobs. Our business correspondent Mark Ashdown reports.
Ministers say it's crucial to train young people with the skills needed to deliver major projects in industries such as energy, maritime and defence. As part of its £725 million growth and skills levy, the government is cutting some apprenticeship approval times from 18 months to as little as 3 months. The training of under-25s will also be fully funded for small and medium-sized companies in a bid to boost engagement and create 50,000 new apprenticeships. There has been criticism that the system in England is riddled with poor quality training and dropout rates of around 40%. But the government said by cutting red tape and bureaucracy, it can help more young people into work and support employers in sectors which are critical to growth, productivity and national infrastructure.
The parents of two teenage sisters who were unlawfully killed in the Hillsborough disaster are launching a campaign to change official court records surrounding the circumstances of their children's deaths. Trevor and Jenny Hicks's daughters, Sarah and Vicky, were among 97 Liverpool fans who died as a result of the crush in Sheffield in 1989. Initially, police said the girls died without prolonged suffering. Later, proceedings established that wasn't true, but there's currently no mechanism to record the change on court documents. The Washington Post says its chief executive, Sir William Lewis, has left the paper with immediate effect. The announcement comes just days after he sacked hundreds of journalists. In his message to staff, Sir William said he'd made difficult decisions to ensure the Post's future, but now was the right time to leave. The authorities in northern Italy say they believe that three incidents of suspected sabotage affecting railway lines might have been linked to the first official day of competition at the Winter Olympics. The damage caused disruption for thousands of travellers. Our World News correspondent Joe Inwood reports.
A small cabin set alight near Pesaro, electric cables severed in Bologna, and a rudimentary explosive found nearby. All three incidents were discovered by the Italian authorities within a few hours of each other. There were some delays to the state-run rail network. Italy's transport minister called them serious sabotage, most likely designed to disrupt the first full day of the Winter Olympics. Matteo Salvini compared them to similar attempts to sabotage the French rail network as Paris hosted the Summer Games. On Thursday, Italian authorities say they foiled a number of cyber attacks, which they blamed on Russia.
At the Winter Olympics, the veteran American skier Lindsey Vonn will be hoping to overcome a knee injury to win back the downhill title she last won in 2010. At the age of 41, she's also hoping to become the oldest downhill skier to win an Olympic medal. And the teenaged British snowboarder Mia Brooks begins her campaign for a medal in the Big Air event. Rugby Union and England have got their Six Nations campaign off to a strong start. They beat Wales 48-7 at Twickenham. The England head coach, Steve Borthwick, was delighted with the performance.
Pleased with the start of the game. I thought the players approached it with a great mindset. And clearly to start the championship with that result, we're very pleased.
Earlier, Scotland lost 18-15 to Italy in Rome. Now for a look at the papers, and the Sunday Times says the payoff to Lord Mandelson after he was removed as ambassador to the US will likely add to the pressure on Sir Keir Starmer. The Sunday Mirror headlines on the Labour heavyweight Lord Blunkett's message to the Prime Minister, get your act together. The Sun on Sunday's editorial says Sir Keir can't shift this vetting scandal stench. According to the Sunday Telegraph, Sir Keir is said to be devastated and considering his future. The paper adds that the Deputy Prime Minister, David Lammy, has let it be known that he had not been in favour of appointing Lord Mandelson as ambassador. The Mayor of London, Sir Sadiq Khan, tells The Observer that it would be a mistake to oust Sir Keir. Football is a 90-minute game, he says. You wouldn't dream of saying in the 35th minute because you're 2-0 down, we'll take all the players off and sack the manager. The Mail on Sunday says it's unearthed emails that show Jeffrey Epstein took a Romanian model in her early 20s to a private dinner at Buckingham Palace with Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. It says the former prince entertained Epstein and four women at the palace while Queen Elizabeth was away at Balmoral. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has always denied any wrongdoing. The Sunday Express says the Red Arrows may use foreign-built jets for the first time. It says government dither and delay in picking a replacement for the ageing British Hawk aircraft has tipped the balance to US firms. A spokesperson for the Ministry of Defence says no final procurement decisions have been made. The Express also carries pictures of a 15-foot gold sculpture of President Trump. It says the statue, dubbed Don Colossus, was commissioned by cryptocurrency entrepreneurs and backers of the president and depicts the moment he raised his fist after an assassination attempt in Pennsylvania in 2024. It's fool's gold, according to the Daily Star Sunday, which reports that the sculpture languishes unwanted in storage because the artist hasn't been paid in full. And that's the news and papers this morning.
Many thanks, Lisa Costello. This is BBC Radio 4. It's 8:10, time now for Sunday Worship, which comes from the Northern European Cathedrals Conference at Exeter Cathedral.
Good morning and welcome to Exeter Cathedral. I'm the cathedral's precentor, Canon James Mustard. Our service today is part of this year's Northern European Cathedrals Conference. The conference meets every 2 years to bring together delegates from cathedrals across Britain, Ireland, Iceland, Scandinavia, the Baltic States, Germany, and the Netherlands to consider our shared public and ecclesiastical ministries. This year, 85 delegates are meeting here in Exeter to reflect on cathedrals as seats of wisdom. Exploring these sacred spaces as places of Northern European identity and culture, wisdom and rootedness. Our opening hymn encourages us as a worldwide Christian community to join together in praise to the Lord, the Almighty, the King of creation. Let us pray. Almighty God, who called your church to witness that in Christ you are reconciling the world to yourself, help us so to proclaim the good news of your love, that all who hear it may be reconciled to you through him who died for us and rose again and reigns with you in the unity of the Holy Spirit, one God, now and forever.
Amen.
Central to the Northern European Cathedrals Conference here in Exeter this year is The Exeter Book, an Anglo-Saxon volume recognised by UNESCO as one of the world's principal cultural artefacts and widely regarded as the oldest surviving book in the English language. It's now on public display for the very first time since its arrival here in Exeter with our first bishop, Leofrich, in the year 1050. And it was given by him to the cathedral in 1072. As we meet, we're considering the Exeter Book's relationship to Northern European culture and how, as an ancient text, it might still speak to us today. In a moment, Dr. Eleanor Parker will introduce and read an extract from the book. But first, the choir sings Psalm 46, which assures us that if we hope and trust in God, he will be with us even in the most difficult times. The chant is by Martin Luther, the German priest, theologian, and author, who was the catalyst of the 16th century Protestant Reformation in Northern Europe.
The Anglo-Saxon poem, Maxims 1, preserved in the 10th century Exeter book, opens by inviting the reader to join a conversation about wisdom. Question me with wise words, it begins. Fria mec, frodum wordum. And it goes on. Wise people should exchange sayings. First, one should praise God with fair words, our Father, because in the beginning he granted us life and fleeting desires. He gives us thoughts, diverse minds, different voices. Many islands, far and wide, contain manifold kinds of life. Spacious lands, the ordainer, Almighty God, has established for mankind, and just as many nations and customs. A meeting should be held, the wise with the wise. Their hearts are alike. They always settle conflicts, teach peace, which unhappy people have previously destroyed. Counsel must be with wisdom, the right with the wise, the good with the good. Like many poems in the Exeter book, these lines from Maxims 1 imagine wisdom as a resource that is meant to be shared, not something accumulated only for the benefit of the individual, but a treasure that is put to best use when exchanged with other people. This poem marvels at the great diversity of lands and nations across the earth, each with their own customs, as evidence of God's limitless creative power, the countless varieties of life which he has established throughout the world. The meeting of wise people from these different lands is an opportunity to share their wisdom, the fruits of their diverse minds and voices. The Exeter Book itself is a book of many voices, a poetic anthology which contains an astonishing variety of works of many different genres and kinds. There are poems of lament, stories of Christ and his saints, and lyrical descriptions of the natural world, as well as a famous collection of very ingenious riddles. A particular interest in many of the poems is the question of how to acquire and use wisdom, the kind of wisdom that can be a comfort in times of suffering, a contribution to the common good of society, or a guide on the soul's journey towards God. Wisdom is presented as something gained by learning, by experience, and by listening with attention to the many different voices which the poems of the Exeter Book allow us to hear. And Maxims 1, reflecting on the great multiplicity of minds and peoples God has created throughout the earth, imagines wisdom as the force that brings unity to this diverse world. Wise people of all backgrounds share the same spirit. Their hearts are alike, and when they meet, they find kinship, exchange sayings, spread peace. Frod with Frodner, the wise with the wise.
Thank you.
Charles Villiers Stanford's setting of the first verse of Psalm 119. Blessed are those whose ways are blameless, who walk according to the law of the Lord. Our reading from the New Testament is from St. Mark's Gospel. It's read by Lars Ostrand, Canon Precentor and Vice Dean of Uppsala Cathedral in Sweden.
One of the scribes came near and heard them disputing with one another. And seeing that he answered them well, he asked him, "Which commandment is the first of all?" Jesus answered, "The first is, 'Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your mind, and with all your strength.' The second is this, 'You shall love your neighbor as yourself.' There is no other commandment greater than these." Then the scribe said to him, "You are right, teacher. You have truly said that he is one, and besides him there is no other, and to love him with all the heart, and with all the understanding, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself. This is much more important than all whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." When Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." After that, no one dared to ask him any question.
In a moment, we'll hear from our preacher, the Bishop of Exeter, the Right Reverend Dr. Mike Harrison, reflecting on how our cathedrals may be places of accumulated wisdom. But before that, we join together to sing the hymn, "In Christ There Is No East or West."
Viktor Frankl was an Austrian doctor and psychiatrist. He became head of the neurology department at a hospital in Vienna in 1940. He was also a Jew, and in 1942 he and his family were sent first to the Theresienstadt concentration camp and then on to Auschwitz. He survived 3 years in 4 different concentration camps to become a psychotherapist of considerable reputation. He reflected that in order to survive in the concentration camp, one needed to stop continually reflecting on what we expected of life, but to ask rather what life expected of us. To stop asking life for something and instead consider what life was asking of us, daily and hourly. Living this way of thinking himself enabled his survival, his sanity, his strength. And later, Frankl's work suggested the will to meaning in human life is primary, and that the will to pleasure or power is secondary, poor substitutes for a frustrated will to meaning. Frankl argued that as human beings we search for meaning and to realize particular values, and the reduction of this to the pursuit of mere satisfaction or gratification demeans our true humanity. Viktor Frankl could be described as wise, engaging a practical intelligence to navigate life in ways which were meaningful and indeed good. And perhaps his example gives us a clue to what wisdom really is. Wisdom is something more than mere information. It is something more than intellectual know-how. It's something more than the raw computational processing power so prized these days. Wisdom, of course, includes information, the intellect and processing, but it goes beyond such things. It is about leading life well, living purposefully, indeed living the good and the meaningful life. And hence wisdom's relevance today, where some social commentators have suggested a meaning crisis. The creeping sense that we don't understand what exactly we're living for, what indeed we're aiming at, and what that entails for us practically. Jesus is pretty clear from our gospel what we are living for and what that entails. The love of God and of our neighbour. And Jesus in his teaching is at pains to describe a God whose fierce compassion for us is such that he is incapable of keeping his distance from us or his dignity in desiring us. Take, for example, the father of the prodigal son, training his sight on the horizon to espy the longed-for return of his child. And when he does, running to meet him, forgetting his own dignity. We are, in contrast, too often enthralled to a God who keeps his distance with a disapproving expression and folded arms, a God who needs to be lured to love us. It is an untrue image of God we cling to, despite all the evidence of the New Testament. As if we are more comfortable with a God who might be impressed by our behaviour, when in fact, whether God is impressed or not is entirely irrelevant to his love for us. The God Jesus tells us to love is the Father of the prodigal, the God who loves us, who is on our side, who seeks us, and who is relentless. To love this God is for Jesus what the commandments are about, what life is about, what wisdom is about. And wisdom too, then, to love our neighbour, for whom God's love also burns with fierce compassion. Grasping Jesus' wisdom is central to the work of cathedrals as seats of learning, of deepening faith, of getting our story straight about God, human beings, and our world. And so cathedrals' business is partly about cultivating wisdom, being helped to see something that we would not know unless we have been told. And of course, to do so, we must cultivate the art of paying sustained attention, giving time to listen carefully, and allowing space for consideration. And where does such wisdom lead? Well, this service and the services held in cathedrals make it pretty clear. Such wisdom leads to praise. At the heart of cathedral life, we find praise. Because to grasp the God of goodness, truth, and beauty embodied in Jesus and his teaching inevitably elicits praise. Indeed, the scriptures suggest the recovery of praise is close to the heart of the transformation of human life. The Christian gospel suggesting our praise is the proper end of human life, that for which we were made. The praise of such a God is found not in speaking and hearing alone in cathedrals, not only in liturgies and song, but in the very stones themselves, in the architecture, in the loveliness of such buildings. So there is much about cathedrals that is connected with wisdom, and very good reason, therefore, to have as the theme for this year's Northern European Cathedral Conference, cathedrals as seats of wisdom. Cathedrals stand as a refusal to have our landscape flattened of references to the divine, and often in Bedia hats in the air exuberance about the divine. Cathedrals stand as places of worship, refusing the centrality of self-preoccupation and thereby enabling us to be found as we are lost in praise. And cathedrals stand as places to practice attending, most particularly to the word and the way of Jesus, as that which offers us a flourishing otherwise beyond us. Such is something of the wisdom that our cathedrals provide. Thanks be to God.
Thank you.
Christ whose glory fills the skies, a setting by Thomas Armstrong, organist here at Exeter Cathedral in the late 1920s, of words by the prolific hymn writer and leader of the Methodist movement, Charles Wesley. Our prayers are led by Andreas Hilmo Granditig, precentor and vicar of Nidaros Cathedral in Trondheim, Norway.
Let us pray. O eternal God, the fountain of all wisdom, who sent your Holy Spirit to lead your disciples into all truth, grant to us here assembled the grace and gifts of the Spirit. May it rule our hearts and guide our conversations, that in all things we seek only your glory and the good of your holy church. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Remember, O Lord, your church throughout the whole world. Strengthen the bonds between churches, cathedrals, and their leaders. We pray for the Pauvu Communion of Churches, the Meissen Commission, and all ecumenical bodies. Deliver the church from evil and strengthen it by your love and the preaching of the everlasting gospel. Gather the faithful from the ends of the earth into the kingdom which you have prepared. For yours is the power and the glory for ever and ever.
Amen.
We say together in English or in our own language the words of the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done, on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses, as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power and the glory, for ever and ever. Amen.
Today we've heard about the relationship between wisdom and praise and the God who rushes to greet us. And so in thanksgiving for God's love and our ecumenical neighbours, we end our service with the well-known Lutheran hymn, Now Thank We All Our God, after which our bishop we'll say a blessing by our first bishop, Leofrich.
May the Lord give you understanding of his wisdom and his grace, and make you diligent in his service. May he nourish you in the riches of his gospel and make you to persevere in all good works. May he keep your steps from wandering and direct you in the paths of love and peace. And the blessing of God Almighty, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit be among you and remain with you always. Amen.
Sunday worship came from Exeter Cathedral and was led by the precentor, the Reverend James Mustard, and the preacher was the Bishop of Exeter, the Right Reverend Dr. Mike Harrison. The director of music was Timothy Noon, the organist was Michael Stevens-Jones, and the producer was Ben Collingwood. The programme is available now on BBC Sounds, from where you can also click through to a copy of the script. Next week's Sunday worship comes from St. Olave Church in the City of London in a service exploring St. Matthew's Gospel.
Radio 4's Story of America.
I know you, Scarlet.
You can buy me as many fine hats as you like, but I will never need you, Rhett Butler.
In the shadows of the Civil War.
There's no food, there's no money, there's nothing left here but trouble.
An epic tale of love and loss.
Rhett, I'm so sorry.
My darling, I know you didn't love me when we married. Fool that I was, I thought I could change that.
Rhett!
Margaret Mitchell's award-winning novel, Gone with the Wind, begins this afternoon at 3 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Tomorrow is another day.
Now on BBC Radio 4, time for Tweet of the Day. The writer Polly Atkin is particularly fond of owls, which surround her home in the Lake District. But there's one elusive species which she is yet to see.
There's a long-eared owl in my kitchen. It stares at me with its distinctive orange eyes, its brown feather tufts raised, relaxed. It's the bird of the month on my wall calendar. This is the only way I've looked a long-eared owl in the eye. In centuries past, it's said the woodlands of Cumbria were home to large colonies of resident long-eared owls, joined in the winter by migrating fellows. Their low, solemn hoots, like someone gently blowing over the top of a bottle, echoing through the trees. But no longer. I have not yet seen a long-eared owl in the wild. All reports suggest they are particularly secretive, even for owls, keeping themselves to themselves in their high roosts. But I have heard of a local long-eared owl who likes to listen to the radio and will sit in a barn watching their human neighbours work only when the radio is playing. Let us play the songs the long-eared owl wants to hear. Hope they stay.
Polly Atkin, Tweet of the Day, was produced in Bristol by Sophie Anton. Now here's Tom Sanders with In Other News, the series that looks at some positive stories away from the week's main headlines.
Hello from the BBC Newsroom, where our teams put together the bulletins and hourly updates that keep you abreast of what's going on in the world. But here's a promise. For the next 9 minutes, no mention of Peter Mandelson nor Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. Instead, we've been on the hunt for something interesting and different, something uplifting, lost in the daily news blender. How about this? You'll be familiar with the regular updates about hospital waiting lists and ambulance response times. The news is often bad. Well, here's some good. An NHS trust in Shropshire says it's making significant improvements in waiting times. Big numbers. How? Ellen Knight has been to find out.
The Shrewsbury and Telford Hospital NHS Trust is made up of two sites, the Royal Shrewsbury Hospital and Telford's Princess Royal Hospital. These two acute hospitals serve Shropshire's population of close to 500,000 people, as well as patients from across the border in Wales. Recent figures show waiting lists there are falling. More patients, 17% more, are waiting less than 18 weeks for planned or elective treatment than a year ago. And the Trust has significantly improved its cancer care. In November 2025, nearly 86% of patients with suspected cancer received a diagnosis or had it ruled out within 28 days. In November 2024, that figure was 69%. So what's the secret? The Trust's Chief Operating Officer, Ned Hobbs, told me.
We're working incredibly hard to ensure every theatre is running as much as it possibly can be. We're now typically operating on about 1,600 patients a month compared to around 1,200 patients per month previously.
The Trust credits a big chunk of this success to a £24 million elective surgery hub, which opened at the Telford Hospital in 2024. Over the past year, surgical teams say they've performed more than 8,000 elective procedures there. Mr. Saurav Chakravarti is a consultant.
The hub has opened up opportunities where we've managed to do more cases without being impacted by emergency care. The trolleys here are not taken up by emergency patients. As a result, the operating numbers have gone up. All of this has contributed to a good working culture, and it is rewarding to see patients do well.
Patients are also pleased with the results. Melvin Jones is a beef and sheep farmer from Llanfair Carreignon in Mid Wales. He had keyhole surgery on his gallbladder at the Princess Royal earlier this year, and he's impressed.
I went in 7:30 in the morning and I was home by 6:00 in the evening. They moved extremely fast. I had a scan on the 9th of December. I had a pre-op on the 12th of December and I was having my operation on the 12th of January. I can't complain at all, and to think as well that I live on the wrong side of the border, because people here can be waiting a very long time.
One very satisfied livestock farmer ending Ellen Knight's report there. You've heard no doubt of dark matter, dark energy even. What about dark oxygen? Dark oxygen seems to be generated spontaneously by chunks of metal on the seabed, thousands of metres below the surface. As our science correspondent Georgina Ranard reports, scientists are hoping to find out more with the help of two new deep-sea landers.
It is easier to leave Earth and travel hundreds of miles into space than it is to reach our planet's deepest depths. Down there, it is dark, very cold, again very, and there is at least 1,000 times more pressure than on Earth's surface. So when I heard that scientists had engineered two machines to explore the deep ocean for us, I immediately wanted to know more. Professor Andrew Sweetman from the Scottish Association for Marine Science spent years building the machines in his lab and told me about the challenges.
At a depth of 11 kilometres, the pressure is 1.1 tonnes per square centimetre. So think of a Volvo estate car balancing on your thumb. You cannot have circuit boards that are then crushed to a pancake.
The landers are boxy metal frames the size of a small car, with scientific sensors screwed onto the arms and legs. Four squat feet poke out at the base. Test submersions of the machines proved they could descend 12,000 metres. In a few weeks, the machines will be lowered from a ship in the Pacific Ocean and will slowly sink down into the Clarion-Clipperton zone to the west of Mexico. The feet will punch down into the seafloor, measuring oxygen, hydrogen and acidity levels. The researchers are desperate to find out more about a shocking discovery made several years ago. Oxygen was found where science said it shouldn't exist. But there it was, emitted from potato-like nodules on the seafloor. These nodules are coveted by deep-sea mining companies, which want to sell the valuable critical minerals inside. But if they are producing oxygen, they might be feeding animals and plants, which could be damaged by mining. It's a controversial debate without many answers. Yet.
The fact that there are big unanswered questions about this process, what its role in the ecosystem is, and us now having the ability to study that in greater detail is a great thing.
When the landers dig around in this remote, mysterious place, Professor Sweetman and his fellow scientists are hoping they will unlock some of Earth's deepest secrets.
Georgina Ranard. From the dark, we now go all shiny and sparkly Supply chains for gold and precious gems are notoriously opaque, often hiding human rights abuses and environmental exploitation. Communities sit on mineral wealth that others steal. But there is change afoot with a women-led initiative to mine and create ethical jewellery from regions scarred by conflict and repression. Mimi Swaby explains.
Which one's this one?
That's the lapis lazuli from Afghanistan. From...
Can jewellery ever be truly conflict-free? Well, associations of women around the world are not only creating pieces with fully transparent provenance, but doing it in areas that have been marked by conflict or occupation.
Gems and gold, the disproportionate value for something very small. It can be smuggled, it can be moved.
Pippa Small is a jeweller based in London. She's devised a system that links all these networks, creating responsible, traceable supply chains for gold and silver, which help their transformation into jewellery.
God, I really do catch the light. Yeah.
Jewellery which reflects the origins of the precious metals and the women who mined them. The whole process, from the riverbeds of, say, Colombia to a shop floor in New York, is accounted for.
We're really careful to work with small family-run mines. We work with the women panners to be sure how they're sourced.
The gold next goes to a refinery, and from there, a local goldsmith where design collaboration starts.
I can see a tray with gold from Colombia.
They are sourced from a group of women panners. There's none of the toxic chemicals that are often used with mining. They are so conscious of not allowing in illegal gold miners because they want their great-grandchildren to benefit from this treasure in the rivers.
These pieces are made from gold from Choco on Colombia's Pacific coast, a place where gold has shaped identity, conflict and survival for thousands of years. Much of today's mining is informal or illegal and often linked to armed criminal groups. Carmen is a registered miner and member of the Women's Association for Artisanal Miners from Choco.
La minería artesanal.
Mining defines our lives in a challenging and complex way. I think that the woman miner is a fighting woman. We are exposed to gender-based violence, labour exploitation, the dispossession of our lands.
Many people will be wearing gold directly linked to this, but would never know of its bloodied past. Pippa's organisation also has a programme for women in Afghanistan. Mara was part of that programme.
When women are excluded from education and employment, the whole community suffers. Creating and serving my community gave back a sense that my life has meaning beyond survival.
Creating and selling jewellery is empowering. Nadira is from Bethlehem in the Israeli-occupied West Bank.
The orders we've got from international buyers gave us distraction from the devastating news while producing these orders.
Despite numerous logistical and sourcing challenges across these different locations, one thing all the women I spoke to had in common was a determination to continue mining and creating ethical jewellery.
That report from the newsroom's Goldfinger, Mimi Swaby.